Hello, good evening, podcast listeners. It's me, Cinematronics, but we're not doing commentary, surprisingly enough. That's why, which is kind of unusual, because it's normally me who introduces them. But no, we are doing, first let me start, is do you expect us to talk? And joining me,
weren't sure when you subscribe to the podcast, it's do you expect us to talk?
You tell them sort of like rusty on this hosting shit.
Yeah. I clearly haven't given enough lessons, you know, I need to pass on my knowledge.
Yes, exactly. I'm not as slick as professionals now, as Becca. joining me as ever is Miss Becca Andrews. How are you?
Hello.
And Mr. David Bond.
Good evening, folks.
But basically we're going to do a little bit of a catch-up. So we've had a new release, so we're going to talk about John Wick, Chapter 4.
We did promote this as being John Wick, but we've been chatting earlier. Carry on, Chris.
Yeah, so it is going to be a review of John Wick, primarily, but then we'll thought, well, hang about, there was another Creed movie, so we could talk about that as well, as a little add-on to our Rocky series. And,
usually like a summer catch up, but I think we'll do a spring catch up instead. You guys will do a summer one as time goes on.
Well, yeah, I think it's just gonna, and then whatever happens in between, you know,
basically a nice little catch up of films that are out at the moment. And then obviously we'll carry on with our Western series before moving on to the next series.
So given we don't understand our canon completely, this is a non-numbered, this is now a non-numbered episode. It was going to be numbered 2 minutes ago. So, yes, enjoy.
Yeah, I just changed my introduction.
Yeah, Becca got halfway through writing one and it was like, don't worry about it, Becca, it's all right, we changed the one.
And now she's sat there thinking, I could have written that better.
I could have written it better. No, it's fine. And plus, it's been a week, you know, you guys. So.
It has been a week, you're right.
It's been a week. Here we are.
It's had 7 days in it, yes.
Yeah, so it is a week. Yeah, well done. So, what films have we enjoyed?
Well, what films have we enjoyed recently?
If we start with the start of the year, I'll just say quickly a few words on the menu, because when we did the Christmas episode, we signed off with Chris saying, please see it. It's my pleasant surprise of the film. Of the film year, sorry. And I downloaded it that day. And then I saw a sort of new on Netflix or whichever. It might even be
Disney Plus.
It's Disney Plus,
I think it was. Yeah.
I saw a new
edition. Streaming services are available.
Like, for example, this was Wednesday and it's like launching Friday. It's like, oh, all right then. So
David didn't wait to do a Disney Plus subscription.
So I watched it the first night it was on Disney Plus. Well, no, that's not true. I put it on the first night it was on Disney Plus, but I was a bit the worse aware. I fell asleep. But that's no comment on the film. I must say it was terrific. I had a really, really great time with it. And I'm starting to see why I am. Anya Taylor-Joy's a star now, to be honest. Nicholas Holt.
Yeah, she's fantastic, isn't she?
Yeah, he was great in it. And it was just, in service of what, I don't know, but it was a genuinely creepy, unsettling film. It made the film look, food look really good, and I just really, really enjoyed it.
Ralph Fiennes was quite good as well. It's kind of a role that's not very, it's a bit atypical for him, isn't it? He's used to kind of, well, certainly in sort of 80s and 90s, he's very much kind of like Shakespearean actor, thespian, star, you know, star of state and on stage as much as the screen. Obviously does the occasional comedic role to great effect, like in Bruges, for example. He's hilarious in that as like a violent gangster.
Hotel.
In the Craig Erebon films.
Grand Budapest Hotel, very funny in that.
That's the one, yeah, he's fantastic in that as well. And then to play a really creepy restaurateur / serial killer in quite a cerebral thriller. It was just a absolute, what's the word I'm looking for? A brilliant performance, powerhouse performance.
Yeah, and it's all basically a guy who's completely lost it because his art has been undermined, and the only way she gets herself out of it is because he's basically got everyone there to kill them because they've ruined his love for what he does, and she's able to connect with his first love, which was actually cooking in its most basic form. He was working in a burger
like the
bar
basic
as a
burger.
Yeah,
that's why it's so significant when she actually eats the burger at the end, because she doesn't eat anything throughout the whole film. I think. If I remember rightly. And then like one of the last scenes of the film was literally her just like eating this burger.
I definitely want to watch it. I haven't watched it again since. but it is a film that I'm definitely going to rewatch because it's got like, a really fun satire edge to it as well.
It's really clever, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's got high rewatchability, I think.
Okay. It's the pretension of it as well, the very fact that something is clearly off from the very start, but they're all trying to convince themselves it's part of this artistic experience.
Yeah,
I think we could definitely our way in for that.
The bit we can all identify with is, I'm sure at some point in our lives, be it a painting or famously back in the sort of Tracy Emin era, the sort of Tate Modern type stuff.
Oh, the 90s, yeah.
I'm sure we've all looked at a piece of so-called art in our lives and gone, are we just too thick to understand this?
Well, specifically modern art as well, because it's very, I mean, it is, I mean, everything's like subjective, isn't it?
So when you don't, to your point of view,
it's like,
I've done it with films.
Is there a made bed? Is it art? Is it her tent with all the names of her past lovers? Is it art? Is Damien Hirst, Cowan from Aldehyde, is it art? You know, that sort of thing.
Mm. And I think that's it. When you don't know, you're caught in two minds, certainly when you're with people and you don't quite understand something. Do I bluff this or do I freely admit I don't know what's going on?
Yeah, I don't know what's going on.
And the vast majority of the people there are pretentious enough to not bluff it, to say they think they know that this is some artistic experience.
There's also an element of polite. I mean, maybe it's the Britishness and this, like, of like being like, well, let's not say anything to... Like, let's not say what we really think, because you know,
yeah, let's be polite about it,
because that would just be embarrassing. But then, as Dave said, there's always something like you don't want to, like, there's always like this paranoia of like, am I missing something really obvious?
And
it's
the obvious thing. If you were convinced everyone else in the room didn't get it, you'd probably say, but it's this. I don't understand the film. I mean, it's like, this has happened in a few because I'm not smarter, but I'm certainly a bit more cine literate. And certainly in the last week or two, talking about films with my wife, I've mentioned at least two films in the last 10 days that she's gone, yeah, I saw it, but I didn't understand it. And I'm thinking, you've almost got more balls than me, because I'm not sure I would have admitted that straight away.
Yeah.
I think culture has a lot to do with that as well. I think in British culture as well, we just generally kind of go with the flow, and like if we try to, certainly in our sort of peer group, or people who are perhaps outside our peer group, even definitely, we try to kind of appear a bit more savvy, you know, kind of put them in front. I think obviously, especially, you know, because you're right, because she's not, you know, because of being Romanian and everything, so it brings a different sort of culture aspect to it. Yeah. But you know, some of us Brits are a bit more ballsy, and you know, if we don't understand something, like. On this sort of family chat, we were talking about like silent films, for example, and I just said that, like, I'm really sorry, I'm sticking my hand up here, there's a big gap in my knowledge, and maybe I've seen like one Charlie Chaplin film, one Harold Lloyd film, and that's it, and otherwise I'm just completely dumb about the whole thing.
Yeah, and that applies to all silent films with slapstick as well, which is clearly not
well,
the
yeah,
case.
Well, yeah, obviously it's very clever, definitely, but I just said, oh, that's a big gap in my knowledge, and you know, to admit something like that to a relative of mine who is like family film nerd. And I was like, oh, but The Menu definitely is a wonderful film. If you guys haven't sorted it out yet, on Disney Plus, check it out. Other streaming platforms are available. I think we're assuming
it's Disney Plus in the UK.
Yeah.
And we know a lot of you aren't in the UK, but it may well be on your platform too. Second film I just wanted to mention. I mean, we are, as I say, we're gonna focus a lot of what we say tonight around a couple of fairly recent releases. But just running through a few things I've seen. Some of these things are going to be from last year. It's just as I got to them this year. I got sent a screener, virtually no notice. Set the tape. I was written to by the person who runs the site, and she says, I got a screener from this film. I've just literally been offered it, and I thought of you. And she thought of me because it was Bond related.
Ah.
And I said, and literally, this was like, for argument's sake, I'm not sure it was, but let's just say it was a Saturday afternoon. And I went, well, I ain't doing nothing. And so she sent it through, and I watched it then and wrote like a review immediately. And it only went up on the site a day or two ago. Actually, I wrote it about 3 weeks ago. It's a film called The Other Fellow. Have you heard of it?
Oh, yeah, is this the one about other people named James Bond?
It's the most tenuous link in the world for a Bond completist. I mean, I feel sorry for Bond fans out there who think, oh, I ought to buy it. It's like when you
especially
don't...
Especially because your surname is Bond.
Well, it's when you don't really like... It's a bit like when you don't really like... I mean, I can understand it with the Eon films, because people treat them as a set. I mean, some people a bit stronger of character will say, well, actually, I only like these eight. Let's just buy those eight. But most of us are completist on it. But you know how we've all got this strange relationship with either Never Say Never Again or Casino Royale 1967. I certainly know people who would argue the opposite, and I actually don't want to split that hair. The point is, it's where you go and buy them out of completeness, and perhaps you don't like them. Casino Royale 67, I've had two or three copies of in my life, and I keep selling it on because I don't really like it. I think it's a mess. And the other fella, I just feel sorry for people who end up going to buy that and then watch it and just go, this is so tenuous. It follows people around who are called James Bond and what it's like to live with that name. And they start with some Scandinavian guy who I would imagine some of the most committed fans will have heard of. He voluntarily changed his name to James Bond.
Oh, wow. Well, that doesn't count then, does it?
No, but he went on like...
Does that count?
I can't remember what country he's from, but for argument's sake, he went on Finland's Got Talent, right?
I was going to say, why did he change his name?
Because he was obsessed with James Bond, right?
But I see.
But he's now middle-aged. And
he regrets this decision?
No, he's shallow as fuck. He was abandoned as a kid by his dad. And there's no self-awareness that this is where this all comes from, right? Because he doesn't do relationships. He went on Finland's Got Talent, or whatever country it was, and just danced around with a tux on with a gun in his hand and some girls. And the feedback was all, this is really shit. Oh. And he goes on about, he's not interested in relationships. And at the end of the film, it cuts back to him and he's going to a grave. And you think, finally, he's had some insight and he's going to, like, his late father's grave and trying to make his peace with, you know, not all relationships have to be shit because my dad legged it. And he's actually at Ian Fleming's grave, and I'm thinking, you can't educate pork. The next guy called James Bond is an American, and he's like he's a theatre director or writer or something from New York. And on the one hand, he's really interesting because he's by far the smartest of the people they interview. But he's also the whingiest. He complains that the name is stupid. He complains that he doesn't like the films. He complains that everyone makes jokes about it. He complains that through his entire life, Bond films have been released on average every couple of years. I mean, he's in his 50s, so there was a time when that was the case. And it's all shit and it's all stupid and people are fucking idiots. The next thing he does is sign up to do a casino advert for an online casino company based on the fact he's called James Bond. And then after he does that, he whinges about it. And I'm thinking, change your fucking name then and stop trying to cash in on it, then complain. But you do get people...
Yeah, don't complain about it and then cash
in. But then you do get people who are, like, pulled over by the police, and the police go, name, and they say James Bond. And in America, they nearly end up fucking shot because they're... Cause it's
yeah,
like
they, must, they're they must go, like, oh my God, what, another one?
But yeah, it's about 67 minutes. No, I think 67 minutes was another screener I saw. But it's fairly short. But if you're a Bond completist, don't bother. It's a curiosity. I live with the surname. And what I found was, when I was younger and hanging around more mixed company in terms of how smart people are, I got a lot of jokes about it. But as you get older, A, people grow out of it, and B, you tend to hang around with people who are more like you. And I'm not the sort of person to either call anyone by their surname. I find that quite puerile. Oi, Bondy. No, I'm called Dave. Fuck off. Right? So, and I give off that air, I think. So I don't get any jokes about my names now. And the only ones that I do get are quite sweet. Like, I remember calling a call centre, right? And it wasn't even a joke, it was the pause. Someone said name, and I said David, and then they said surname, I said Bond. And they went, long pause, and then I just Dave heard, Bond. And then I just heard, and then I thought, that's quite sweet. That's funny.
That's probably the best name they had all day. The call centre, you speak to hundreds and thousands of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get a name like that, and you think, oh, that's fun to say.
Yeah.
So you probably gave that poor call.
Well, I mean, living with the name, but name changes are possible and they're not that expensive. It's a ball ache, but that theatre director whining about it, I just think, like, change it or tough shit, you know what I mean?
So you got one guy who changed it.
Voluntarily, because he's obsessed with girls, guns, Fleming and the lifestyle that he perceives he can get. Just the shallowest, like, 50-year-old in the world.
Yeah, but that doesn't count though. You want to speak to people who were generally born.
The rest of them all are. I mean, there's one guy who was like imprisoned, attempted. Well, he was charged with murder. He didn't end up doing it. And there were stories about him and how he dealt with it. And then there was another guy who changed his surname because he just said, "I was sick of it," to be honest. And that was it. And they really varied, but I don't see the point of the film, to be honest with you. Other than there aren't many names like it. I can't think of another name like it where perhaps Margaret Thatcher, maybe.
No, so, I mean, if you get like other sort of celebrity names pop up, I think that James Bond is quite a, you know, a
you don't one get that's most attention. You don't get many Adolfs, do you, these?
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, you don't get many.
I used to work with a lady called Elizabeth Taylor. I mean, she wasn't like, you know, Lisa Taylor or whatever, but we were just like, oh, it's Elizabeth Taylor.
I mean, I remember being, I went with my ex-mother-in-law hurt herself at home. I can't remember how now, but we took her to minor injuries. This was like 10 years ago. Skyfall had been out. No, sorry. It was before Skyfall. So there hadn't been a Bond film for maybe 3 years. So I'm going to guess it was 2011, right? And I'm sat there and we get to this minor injuries unit in a sort of small hospital. And we sign her in. And we're sat down and someone come out and the nurses kept coming out because these are always nurse led functions. And the nurse would come out and name somebody and that person would walk through to have stitches or an X-ray or whatever it was. So he'd come out, Mrs., you know, Julie Smith, please. And so on. And they came out at one point. They said, James Bond, please. And I stood up because I thought they were taking the piss. And then I thought, you haven't signed in. No one knows there's a Bond here. Sit down, you pillock, because everyone's now looking at me. And I sat down and it was the boy sat next to me.
Oh.
And he was about 9 and he was called James Bond and he went through and I'm left talking to his mum and I said, doesn't he get shit for that? And they went, no one knows James Bond now, do they? I'm thinking you might be disabused of that notion.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe wait a year or so.
The following year, the highest grossing Bond film.
Yeah, I was going to say, the following year, the highest grossing Bond film.
But like to think Bond was, I mean, if that kid was 9, he must have been born a couple of years maybe after Die Another Day, and it's like, no, Bond's always been a going concern. It's always been known. But yeah, next cinema release I saw was Babylon.
I've not seen this. I'm kind of interested in watching it. What did you make of it?
Again, in other hands, this film could be deeply pretentious. Because there's nothing. No, I loved it. I did do a written review of it at the headline label, I gave it 4 stars and sort of slaughtered it and said I loved it, which is, and I'll sort of explain that now. There is something a little bit pretentious about filmmakers making films about filmmaking and the film industry. And there's been a lot of it in recent years. You could argue Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is largely about it, but I loved that film, to be fair. It can be a bit of a mixed bag in how it comes out. We're going to get to another one literally next that is about a kid developing a love of film. So it's about the transition from silent era to talkies and how the stars of the time dealt with it. And also it's pre-Hays Code, and so we think of that as a very buttoned up era, and it's not. The first hour of the film is like a completely debauched party.
I was listening to another podcast actually. I think it might, I want to say Screenshot, but it might not have been.
Right.
Actually, no, I think it probably was Screenshot. One of the episodes from last year, all about the Hays Code and that sort of thing. And as you say, yeah, we kind of think of it as kind of very prim, very proper.
No,
it was anything went, anything. And well,
very quickly, the first half hour of the film is drug and drink soaked, copious nudity. Not really an orgy, but there are people having sex in little recesses here and there. The film, the first scene has an elephant shit on someone, and the second scene has a golden shower. Literally a golden shower. So it's quite debauched, and Margot Robbie, her life is, she's really quite wild, and she's desperate to get into the film industry, so she blags her way into this party.
Is this a character or...
Yeah, the character. Brad Pitt's there and he's ending a marriage, like he's gone through loads of them, and he's actually a little cameo from Olivia Wilde. That marriage is coming to an end. And basically, this is something like 1925. We know the talkies sort of begin the following year. We see Margot become a star, but then we see early attempts to capture sound and stuff like that, and how like frustrating it is for them because, A, they weren't trading on their voices. And suddenly they're speaking, and some of them don't have the right voice. Of course, now you've got to hit marks, not just for the camera, but for where the microphone is. And, you know, it brings an extra complexity of, like, electronics and heat and everything like that. And then, and I don't really want to say much more about it. It was a mess in that it's 3 hours long. It's arguably too long. But it's fantastic. You know, the first section you see is like a party out in this house in the middle of nowhere. The implication is it's either in Mexico or very near the Mexican border. And then they go to film all these silent films, and they're almost in little... It's almost like being at an outdoor fair, in that it's a load of stalls almost next to each other filming scenes, because there's no sound. You can't interrupt. You could film 5 feet away from me, and it's not going to interfere with what I'm doing, because we're not capturing sound. And so you've got all this filming going on at the same time. Like, health and safety, no such thing. Incredibly dangerous the way they're going about stunts and things like that. But you also see the magic that it captures in, say, Margot Robbie, as she captures the camera just loves her. And the camera loves Brad Pitt, but when it goes to sound, it suddenly doesn't anymore. It's an absolute mess, and it is very, very adult. It's not for everybody, but, like, watch it. It handles its running time incredibly well, and it feels expensive. It's a bit... It's lavish. It's also a bit indulgent. It's the sort of thing that Hollywood likes making films celebrate in itself. It bombed, but just keep giving Damien Chazelle money, because more often than not, he will make you money. He's now... What is it, 3 for 3 or 4 for 4? Whiplash, this First Man. What was the other one? Hasn't he made 4?
La La Land.
La La Land. So that is 4 incredibly different films. All speak to, certainly 2 of them speak to a love of cinema, and that La La Land is effectively like a reprise of the great musicals. But he's 4 for 4. That doesn't mean you have to love all 4. But they all have, like, an incredible amount to recommend them. And you've got Whiplash, which is just an absolute open wound of a film. And then you've got, like, La La Land, which is polished. And then you've got First Man, which is quite austere, but beautifully shot. And then you've got this, which is, like, one big party. Fantastic film, honestly, but not for everybody. I think there are plenty of people that will watch it and just go, no, no, not for me.
He does seem like one of those directors who, like... I mean, I haven't quite got a grip of, like, what type of filmmaker he is.
You don't recognise a Damien Chazelle film, no.
Because everything is just so vastly different, and at the moment, that's what I'm kind of liking. I'm liking, like, you know what, it tends to be, like, you know, your Tarantino, your Tim Burton's, who have, like, you know, they have a set, like, a kind of, like...
They're really stylised, aren't they? They have a unique look to
it
them.
It either looks like them or sounds like them, yeah.
Yes. They have, like, you know, or maybe a Scorsese where, like, you know, they do it. There's a type of tone, usually, you know, kind of like, you know what a Scorsese film kind of what to expect, but
you know what you're getting in for.
But here, just like with Chazelle, it just seems to be like all over the place. It's like 1 minute he could do something like, you know, he could do flat out, like, you know, Adam Sandler comedy next, you know, yeah, do you know what absolutely. I mean? And then do, like, do something completely different.
I saw La La Land once and I wasn't really concentrating and I didn't engage with it. I thought it looked lovely, so I've almost got to drop that one out. But this is certainly, like, his funniest film. But it's not flat out a comedy, but just the disregard of this era. I mean, there's a film early in the film, Brad Pitt, like, gets talking to the waitress. His marriage is just broken up. She's clearly starstruck by him. They end up having, like, a brief tryst that evening. A few scenes later, that she's found dead. Like, she's just because he's gone and married someone else. You know what I mean? And later on, that marriage breaks up as well. And you do have sort of press commentary on it, because you've got, like, a journalist in the film played by Jean Smart. Who's like an actress who's probably about 70 now, but you've seen her in lots of things, sitcoms and everything. She was in episodes of Frasier years ago and stuff. And I just thought it was a really special film, but I also acknowledge it was a complete mess. I mean, it was just so ill-disciplined. Most scenes ran too long. I mean, the opening parties are 30, 35 minutes. I mean, even The Godfather, which opened with a wedding, that was only 20, 25 minutes. And it just took so long for the film to get going and really sort of start to coalesce as to what it was trying to tell us. And it did have themes. And it had themes about... It's about really the transience of it all. That Brad Pitt was a massive star in the film, I mean. And then he's not. And just the chemistry changes. The chemistry between the audience. He's in a film, gives a perfectly good performance, so the audience is laughing at him. Because his time has passed for whatever reason. And... The point is that you will live a very short period of fame, and losing that fame will be really painful, but it's a price you pay for a kind of immortality, because there are kids who haven't even been born yet who in 50 years time will watch something with you in it and connect with it. And Gene Spark pretty much says that to him.
Yeah.
I'll check it out. I didn't see it, unfortunately. But yeah, I saw your review. Listeners, if you're ever... at a loss, or if you ever want to check out obviously the latest film reviews or what's out on the big and small screens, check out Set the Tape on Facebook and Twitter, across all your social medias. Particularly check out Dave's reviews, very succinctly written. Passion always comes across very well. I love when you get screeners of other home releases, for example, you go through the extras with a fine teeth comb, which is fantastic.
I don't know why I committed to that when RoboCop came out, and I was there for a fucking week watching everything.
make sure you get value for money.
Well, it's normally an afternoon, you know what I mean? There's normally, like, particularly if it's an old film, it's normally a quick interview with Kim Newman, a quick visual essay, and you're done.
Newman. Yeah. He pops up on all the Studio Canal releases. It's generally Kim Newman.
But then I'd say the RoboCop release recently, it was three different cuts of the film.
That's amazing. That sounds like
when you think two of the cuts are almost identical, there's only a few seconds difference. I needn't have done that, really. And there's a commentary on each of two of the versions. And then there's all the original extras from like the earliest releases. And then there's new ones from this, and you are there for a very long time. But there you go. The next film I saw, obviously chip in with anything you've seen in the interim, but there's a thematic similarity here. Well, obviously we're in awards season when this came out. Steven Spielberg's The Fablemans. I'm led to believe he left the forthcoming Indiana Jones project for a couple of reasons. One of them was West Side Story. The other one was The Fablemans. If it was lack of commitment to the material, or he went off it, or he wasn't getting good results, as happens sometimes, we don't know that yet, because he doesn't tend to spill the beans like that. But yeah, The Fablemans is probably the most personal film he's made since...
Yeah, it's almost like semi-autobiographical, isn't it, pretty much?
I suppose it depends what you mean by personal, because certainly he often says that after he married Kate Capshaw made a full conversion to Judaism. She wasn't actually born or raised Jewish, but the process of her converting led him to connect with his faith much more, rather than just culturally being Jewish. So you may argue Schindler's List would have meant a lot to him and stuff like that, but certainly in terms of the experience of growing up a child of divorce and in a certain kind of town.
Jewish as well.
You're looking at this in E.T., really. But this is literally his story. I mean, obviously The Fablemans, I suppose that's a play on the word fable, the storytellers. But the parents do split up in this. His father did work for Agfa or Kodak or something like that, and did work on the earliest versions of computers and stuff like that, which is exactly what Paul Dano's character does. The mother was a pianist, as was Michelle Williams' character in this. They did divorce. He had largely sisters. That's the same here. I don't think it's the same film that they go to see, but certainly he goes to see a certain film as a young man, which isn't the same. But when he meets John Ford late in the film, the poster on the wall, I think, is the same, The Greatest Story Ever Told. That was the story he'd seen. But anyway, he sees a train crash in the film, and in the first film he goes to see at the cinema, he's transfixed by it. We've all got stories about
it. Liberty Valance is one of the other films.
It's the man who shot Liberty Valance.
When he goes to see who plays John Ford?
I can't remember now. It's been a while. Wikipedia.
Brad Pitt film?
Is it David Lynch? Lynch.
Let me just Wikipedia this film. Give me a second and I will tell you. Because I get confused between the first film Spielberg ever saw and the film they're seeing in this. Because the film they're seeing in this I've either not seen or I've not seen for a very long time, so I forgot it. Yeah, they've gone to see The Greatest Show on Earth.
Sure enough, that was it.
I think the first film Spielberg saw was The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which was on the wall when he meets John Ford towards the end of the film as a poster. Because my wife turned to me and said, isn't that the film we were seeing at the start of the film? And immediately I said yes, but I realised I was conflating the two stories. Because I thought, hey, would there be a train in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance? But anyway.
No.
John Ford, I'm just trying to see who played him, and I'm not seeing it. I'm not seeing it. I don't suppose it massively matters. But anyway, he sees a train crash. And some of the things, because we're of all of an era where when we went to see films projected, they were proper 35
Yeah, it was David Lynch, I was right.
Well, you saw the...
Amazing cameo. Sorry, I had to say it.
I know, and it looked like John Ford as well. But obviously we can remember...
Look out of my office, I was like, this is brilliant.
And we've talked about it. We've talked about seeing those films in cinemas where you look back and saw where the projected image was coming from. You can't see that quite the same way now. But of course, he's seeing all that. He sees a train crash, which is a stunt using miniatures and everything like that. But it scares him and fascinates him in equal measure. It scares him because it's like a big crash, and it's a bit like the very first film with a train. People thought it was coming out the screen and stuff like that. If you've never seen these things before, they scare you. But he asks for a train
that
set.
I'm pretty sure like when the AFI did their 100... a list of 100 things, like 100 years, 100 scares, 100 thrills, 100 laughs, that sort of thing. I'm pretty sure one of them, it may have been number 100 actually, was like
it was
train
the first
coming
out
of the station or something like that. It was, you know, one of the early films. But I think that myth of that kind of being scary and terrifying to audiences has since been debunked, unfortunately.
I don't know. But the point I'm making is he's scared and fascinated by it. And he says what he wants for Hanukkah, because obviously the Jewish family. And the present he gets, I think we all think as an audience when he opens it, it's going to be a camera, but it's not. It's a train. But I think he's got either got a camera already or gets one as well. I can't really remember the detail. Cause
I think that probably comes next, doesn't it? And then
but anyway, he starts recreating these train crashes and he's actually damaging the trains. But his mother and his father goes crazy at him. And there's a similar story from Spielberg's own life. And his mother does him a deal that I will give you the camera to recreate this. But we don't tell your father. I'll help you with it.
It's a really kind of art versus science, isn't it? Two sides of his family.
He basically, it's then his love of film developing. So he's shooting little 8mm pictures. It then cuts to them. They move with the job to, I think it might be Phoenix, Arizona. And then he becomes like a Cub Scout or something like that. And he does 16mm films for that. And it's all about him developing, starting to work with young like guys, not even actors, but getting certain things out of people. I want you to think this way. And it's about first love, and it's about dealing with divorce. And it's just such a personal film. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. Honestly, I would not have been surprised had it won Best Picture. Not surprised at all. And the kid who played
it's a shame that he didn't actually. It's such a shame because it was slated to kind of win all its kind of Oscars or sort of BAFTAs and everything like that. And it's picked up quite a few awards here and there.
Yeah, but it didn't have Hot Dog Fingers though.
No, it didn't. It didn't have Michelle Yeoh and Ki Hui Kwan.
But it started with him. It started in 1952. Steven Spielberg was born in, I think, 46. So assuming that, we start with him at about 5 or 6. Then it cuts to him later in the 50s as a teenager. It takes you right through to him going to college. Now, Gabriel LaBelle, he's not exactly a dead spit of Spielberg, but I've seen photos of Spielberg as a teenager, and there's a similarity in the features.
Everything looks good that he carries the film, like, for such a young actor as well. And that's to take on quite a big mantle. You know, you're basically like, well, not proto, but kind of like...
Yeah.
Spielberg through a lens,
and a kid starting to realise his parents don't really love each other, and his parents don't look a match. They don't look a very good match anyway. And it's quite clear early in the film she's in love with somebody else, and that happened to him. That happened to Spielberg.
I think they all have good chemistry, though. I mean, they kind of, it's a bit of an odd cast. I think Paul Dano, he's an interesting character actor. He's kind of he's a bit of, for me, he's a bit of a sort of chameleon type actor. Like
he always looks like him, but he can do anything.
A vast array of roles, like literally you can pour himself into any kind of role that you wanted and it'll still be amazing. I think all the cast are fantastic, but yeah, he's kind of like, you can pull off any kind of role, but I just think they all have good chemistry as well. And obviously when it all comes apart, you sort of really, you know, feel for him, and obviously he's kind of stuck in the middle of it all, you know, with his sort of art, you know, his kind of artsy kind of mum on one side and his science scientific sort of father on the other side. And yeah, it's just But I think it's amazing. It's the most personal family film that he's made, I think.
Yeah, the kids are... I mean, he's a filmmaker. His mum's a pianist. I think some of the girls are, like, dancers and things like that. You've got this very cold... He's not cold. He's warm. He loves his family. But he's a bit staid in his way. And he doesn't really understand art. And the parents are not a good match. The one flaw in the film, though, I must say... The caveat is, this is from the boy's perspective, so he's not going to understand the nuance of it. His mum's really irritating. The Mitzi character, Michelle Williams' character, is deeply...
Oh, she's great.
I think she's deeply fucking irritating. And but I think that...
She's a fantastic actress, though.
No, again, I think she's meant to be. She's meant to be. But I think also, it's meant to be a little bit like that, because she's not happy. And
no, she
doesn't understand all this at the start of the film. She's trying to talk herself happy. But yeah, very, very good film. The only strange bit of the film was the cameo from Judge Hirsch. Now, that's his uncle, Judd Hirsch. He plays like a uncle or his great uncle or something
like
that.
Yeah,
he
comes to stay.
It's basically his mother's uncle, and he was an actor. So again, it's this idea that the father is a scientist in a family full of artists. But yeah,
that's
really
like,
good
that's
film.
That's a big impetus for him to, you know, to go into the filmmaking and everything, and then for him to say, you know, to his dad, you know, stop treating it like a hobby. This is something I want to take seriously.
Stories, you know, artists have art. They need to get out, be that
exactly.
singing, dancing, whatever. Yeah.
Go and read, speaking of Kim Newman, go and read his review of the film.
I haven't read it.
It's quite something.
Is it? Did he like it?
He liked it, but I just think the way he described it.
Okay.
Made me laugh. But yeah, go and check out his review. It's really good. I saw it on the strength of his review. And no, I would agree with you, David. Yeah, fantastic film. I think it's certainly his most emotional film. Obviously, all of his films deal with the element of family. Obviously, Indiana Jones. Obviously, E.T. is a big one as well. Also, notions of like God.
But it's
religion.
Almost like he's been trying to tell us things about himself through allegory. I mean,
exactly.
Even,
and now he finally
even,
does it.
He even says Temple of Doom was so dark because he was having marital problems at the time. Well, I don't think
he'd
even married,
yeah.
But he was having relationship problems. And then you look at E.T. and I think he was trying to tell us something about his childhood there and
exactly, and about his father and that sort of
close encounters. He eventually went off with the aliens, and it's like, well, he lost his father in some ways.
Exactly, and here it's kind of like this is it. He's kind of
but this is where now. He's finally gone. You know what? I'm in my 70s now. I'm just going to tell the story. I'll just be brave. You can learn all
about
it.
The film itself comes with a kind of like, there's a pre-recorded message from Spielberg.
Yeah, there is.
And just saying, you know, this is the most personal film. Basically, it says, you know, thank you for coming to see it in the cinema. It's the best place to see it. And this is the most personal film I've ever made, basically. So,
and
which is just, you know, you don't get that very often these days from major directors. So.
Yeah, I did a review of it as well, and like I say, it wasn't a flawless film by any means, but it was like probably my favourite from sort of around Oscar season. I did see a few others, and we might get to a few of them. Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Oh gosh. Oh. You just reminded me of something. I usually do a list of films what I have seen on the old Letterbox, but I haven't so far, so I'm going to have to go list everything.
That's alright. We'll just go through.
I haven't seen this either, and I think... It's partly down to the state of Marvel.
I did go and see.
I just don't care.
Tests, yeah,
like I've got no drive to even bother.
Well, it's pretty severe because I remember I was watching Toy Story 2 last night because I'm sure showing my wife something. Now I remember Pixar. They released Toy Story, then they released A Bug's Life, which I didn't love. But then they went Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, The Incredibles.
They had a good run, didn't they?
And then they released Cars, and everyone went, oh my god, they've shit the bed. And then they came back and went... Then they went Ratatouille, Wall-E, Up, Toy Story 3. So they had one argued misfire, although I quite like Cars, to be honest. But they had one argued misfire in just over a decade.
But did Cars 2 come out?
Cars 2 was, I think, next off the rank. I think it was 2011 or 12, something like that.
Yeah, it was
that.
Around the summer, wasn't it?
But then it was like The Good Dinosaur and Monsters University. And
everyone said that The Good Dinosaur was probably up, perhaps their...
It was garbage.
For them.
I didn't like it. I thought it was terrible.
I didn't see it, unfortunately.
It looked like... It got retooled late. Now, sometimes that could work. It worked okay with Toy Story 2, which was meant to be for TV, and then they decided to put it on the big screen, and it was all animated at breakneck speed, and that worked out. It doesn't always, and it didn't with The Good Dinosaur. The whole idea of the plot changed late, and it became the most cloying shit in the end. But anyway, what I'm saying is, in the early 2010s, you had people going, God, how did a studio that was so great go away, go so bad so quick? And actually, what's happened in the years since is their hit rate's not as strong, and their sequels are a little bit more hit and miss, but Pixar still make the occasional absolute gem. But Marvel have gone from Endgame at the end of three fantastic phases, some misfires, some not so great, but like a unique cinematic experience, and they've gone to a phase I thought was nearly all garbage. And you can argue about individual films, and I think people get too hung up on the individual films. I hated She-Hulk, and I had people get annoyed with me for that. They were like, oh, it was really good, and it was just like the comics, and I'm like, yeah, all right, whatever. But I just think the whole trend of it is aimless, directionless, cloying, superficial. And so, yeah, I don't even know how to critique it without looking at the individual parts. I thought it started okay with WandaVision. I thought the Falcon and Winter Soldier was okay. And then the film started coming out, and I'm thinking, that's not very good. That's a bit ordinary. And then I thought, that should have been made 5 years before, and they've got no ideas here. And then I thought, that's weak. And then the TV shows were getting worse and worse. And I don't want to become all middle-aged man and talking about messaging in that, but that all felt really forced as well in some places. And I just thought, and then it had no direction, and the Thor film was dreadful. And then Black Panther was, they did the best they could, but that, and I just thought all of the constituent, you could argue about individual bits, but I got to the end of the phase and just thought, what was the point of all that? And I thought, okay, well, they've consciously gone, here and now is phase five. So I thought, well, if they're consciously calling this the start of a new phase, maybe this will be better. I think part of the problem with phase four is there was just too much of it. I mean, the effects were largely terrible because they were all stretched too thin. There were 17 different products. That's too much in like a couple of years.
I think we have kind of reached Marvel overdrive.
Well, yeah. I went to watch this and it's garbage. I mean, it's just awful. There's a character of MODOK in it, and just look that character up. Take one look at the picture of what they did with that effect. And
that's, yeah,
it does look terrible.
That is really everything that you need to know about Marvel's quality control now.
I thought visually the film did actually look quite good. It's like when they get to the kind of the quantum realm, I thought, wow, this is visually quite stunning. Like, but that particular character, the audience...
Let me just tell you what the problem is, right? And you're never going to get me, because I'm quite liberal and progressive for my colour and generation and age and gender and everything like that. I really am. But I started to feel it in this film. Michael Douglas, completely sidelined. Ant-Man, a bit of a twat.
Yeah, the Wasp, completely sidelined. Completely.
I mean, his daughter telling him, what have you, even this guy literally saved the world, and you've got some upstart daughter going, what have you done for the world lately? And it's like, the guy A saved the world, and B
universe.
All the young girls in Marvel are now fucking geniuses. We got this in Wakanda Forever. We got Ironheart. She just made like she's at Tony Stark quality in her own room, and his daughter has now invented this way to permanently talk to the quantum realm. It's really unfocused. You've got a cameo from Bill Murray, and gone, and it's just an absolute mess.
I kind of feel there's a scene that ended up on the cutting room floor as well, kind of explaining to us about what Mrs. Van Dyne, you know, what she got up to in the quantum realm. So I kind of feel there was a bit missing. I'm like,
The problem is there, that's all made up on the fly, because there's not a chance she wouldn't have come out of the quantum realm and warned them about it.
And survived.
Secondly, because all sorts of bad shit's going on down there she said nothing about. Secondly, the Kang down there. Well, the problem with Kang is obviously...
Missing a beat.
But the problem with Kang is the problem with multiverses. That nothing means anything. You lose one version of a character, like Gamora, just go get another one.
Especially with this new multiverse that's going to be built all around Kang. So
you beat this Kang, go get another one. And the problem with Kang is he's all powerful, so one minute he's doing nothing, the next he's winning easily, and the second he's beaten. And it's just bollocks. Absolute bollocks. It's a mess, honestly. And I cannot think of a studio that has shit the bed this quickly. You know, I mean... normally there are signs. And to use the Pixar example, I think Cars, the original, got... I talk about the logic of it and how would this universe exist. You've missed the point. Cars is basically Doc Hollywood, and it's all right. But there were signs that they're not... just the chink in the armour. Pixar films were coming out to like 98, 99, 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. Cars comes out, all of a sudden a third of the audience or a third of the reviews are like, this isn't so good. So that was like a chink in their armour. But it took another 6 or 7 years to start to release a couple in a row that weren't that good. And even now, they're still hit and miss. Most of Phase 4 you can chuck away, honestly. Even if you take the Par example, for me of Phase 4, like not good, not bad, bang in the middle, would be Shang-Chi. And I couldn't tell you much about Shang-Chi now. Utterly bogged down. It's boilerplate, though. Who remembers?
Visually stunning.
Who is screaming for more Shang-Chi now? And any time there was any tension,
I would be happy for that.
And any time there was any tension in that film, fucking Ben Kingsley cracks a joke. Because Marvel are too scared to like actually make anyone feel any peril.
Successful films like Crazy Rich Asians, obviously Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yeah.
And obviously we've got quite a lot of like Michelle Yeoh and their kind of back catalogue being released in that now. I think there will be a demand for more stories from that part of the world, from that kind of mythology.
That's not my problem though.
And
my
I think problem it'll take a while
there's an
to get
Asian
there.
Lead. My problem is you introduce the Ten Rings in a full phase since you've done nothing with it.
No, exactly. Something further on down the pipeline.
Every time you had tension or stakes, Ben Kingsley cracks a joke. It's just like, can you sometimes let the sense of peril marinate or just hang in the air for a moment?
Before moving on to the next thing.
Yeah.
It is like, well, I think we talked about it's been spread thin now. I mean, look at Doctor Strange, like how many years did it take just for the sequel to come around? With Guardians Volume 3 due out, which is the next one. That's like how many years now from Volume 2?
The problem is, it's overstuffed.
5 years?
It was about 5.5 years for Doctor Strange. I must admit, I quite liked Multiverse of Madness. That's what I'm saying. I'm still claiming the reviews. I'm still going, I'll review that. I'm going to review Guardians 3. I still go in with hope, and I just feel like eventually they'll course correct. They've got a guy at the top of this who has overseen three unprecedented phases of, like, innovation, really, which is rare in superhero things, and a universe that no one thought anyone could make. I was actively speaking out against the idea of the Avengers 3 years before it happened, and it worked. And they kept the plate spinning. I kept thinking it was going to collapse, and it didn't. And so he's clearly clever. The people that were causing problems, like Victoria Alonso, who's overseen all the shitty effects and some of the more dubious decisions in this universe has been canned. And I think they've now got a head of Disney that's saying, we've got to row back on so much of this product. They were supposed to have 5 TV series this year, where in April tomorrow, and April by the time this is released, we haven't had one yet. So there aren't going to be 5. At some point, Disney, I think something like Agatha Harkness, I wouldn't be surprised if they quietly shelve it, because I think they must be seeing there's too much of this and it's not working.
I mean, I'm not being like, I was just going to go through some of this now, because Agatha Harkness, like, they convinced themselves on the meme, thinking that that's going to be a popular thing. It's a fun meme, you know, like, it was Agatha all along, you know, that kind of thing. But
if memes,
that's not...
I'll just say, if memes sold movie tickets, the highest grossing film of all time would be Snakes on a Plane.
Probably, yeah. you're right, though. It's like, but, you know, but there's no actual... Where's the excitement for Agatha? Like, there is none. Echo, does anyone give a shit?
No, because there's too much of it.
Does anyone give a shit
like
about,
I say,
Ironheart, Riri Williams at
no,
the moment?
Some of it needs,
not really.
Some of it is obnoxious. I'm sorry, every young girl being a genius is pathetic, particularly when... And I don't want to be the reactionary middle-aged man, I really don't. But when the lead character ends up being a fucking buffoon, you just go, like, this is getting out of balance now.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you're not being Dave, you're just being honest.
No, but it's not all going to be for me either. There is totally a market for Miss Marvel.
No.
A young female Asian lead. Brilliant. There is totally a market for Shang-Chi. There is a market for She-Hulk. I just wish they'd done it better. Not everything has to be for me. I completely understand that. But I actually think the objective quality of a lot of it has been poor. But even if you like it, there's been too much and it's been too cross-pollinated. Well, we're now at a point, Star Wars is getting like this, that like, to understand certain bits of The Mandalorian, it really helps if you've seen some of Clone Wars, and you have to have seen three episode arc of Boba Fett, and it's like, it's just becoming like, how do I watch this without having to do homework?
Yeah, it's a bit of a crossing. I must say, I went back and watched Loki series because I hadn't seen that. Obviously, I'm not too familiar with Kang. Obviously, not having read the comics, unfortunately.
It would help for it.
And I did sort of go back and watch. You know, there aren't too many episodes; they're quite short. Yeah. Tom Hiddleston is nice to look at, which always helps. But no, I went back and watched sort of Loki series. I thought, okay, try and learn more about his character.
He was a challenging wanker, I must admit.
No, this is it, definitely. But it's one of those things because it is becoming interconnected. And yeah, it's one of those things that there aren't too many kind of standalone now. But no, my point about Shang-Chi is basically, obviously, it wasn't just about the whole kind of like Asian lead sort of thing. I think it's just because there will be a demand for these kind of stories, as there have been for Black Panther, for example. But it'll just take a few years to filter through. So it may not be in the next couple of bit, maybe further on down the line. But I think, yeah, now, definitely with Ant-Man and the third, especially with the new Guardians film that we've got coming up as well. I mean, people said maybe 5-6 years ago we were kind of reaching, peak Marvel, but I kind of think we're kind of reaching there now just a little bit. It's kind of too much.
More than a little bit.
And there's
bit.
Not
we've
much more they
it.
Can do. They've reached it already.
There is a theory that there's about 4 or 5 stages to a genre's lifespan. And I think I said this before, the final stage is parody. And I'm sorry, if you watch Ant-Man and the Wasp, we're watching a fucking parody.
Yeah, that'll kind of morph into there, won't they?
I mean, I know Daredevil's in She-Hulk, so I can't comment on what happened because I haven't seen that. But,
no, a bit of cross-pollination.
But you look at Daredevil and what they're doing with Born Again, it's like, okay, we took something that was relatively a hit. It was cancelled, not because it was failing, but, you know...
It was cancelled because of licensing.
Yeah. So you think, you got the original act, you got the actor, right? Are you going to continue on? No, we're just going to go completely different direction. Why? Yeah. Like you have a golden ticket. You've got already got a cast.
Yeah.
You can just carry on. You've already got the shows on Disney Plus now. You can just do Daredevil season 4. You know, everyone's happy.
They're not focused. A lot of the characters. I mean, Thor, absolute buffoon in his own film, and I just think like. This is the pendulum has swung too far now here, and I look at She-Hulk, and the biggest problem with it is she's not very likable. She's the character's a fucking idiot. Honestly,
I haven't seen it.
Honestly, the character quality of the CG is some of the worst I've seen in 15 years. And yeah, I just thought it was dreadful. And what was bad about it is it kind of was meant to be a comedy, but it wasn't funny. It was meant to be a courtroom drama, but they have no idea how to write courtroom dramas. And in the final episode, she sort of goes in a meta way to the studio to say this product is garbage. And I'm thinking, you've just critiqued your own work. It's dreadful. But the only caveat is, of course, with any individual project, I can sit here and say Phase 4, disastrous mess, and I can defend that. On any individual project, of course it will be according to taste, and I know a lot of people did enjoy She-Hulk, but I bet you there's no Season 2. I bet anyone.
Yeah, it's going to be a one-off.
It's not good enough, and it tanked.
The only thing I could see coming up that will be success is Guardians 3. Yeah. Marvel's I doubt will be anything particularly good. Captain America 4.
Captain America 4 intrigues me simply because Liv Tyler's back, as is Samuel Stern's character.
That's gonna be amazing.
Yeah, but I don't know. I just think it's done. I think like people's like, well, it's not Captain America though. So
no.
Why Thunderbolts kind of Suicide Squad. Maybe might have a bit of
Hang
Blade.
On, Suicide Squad?
No, the Thunderbolts is kind of like their
version of. Sorry, yeah. But the thing is, idiot that I am, I keep going in with hope. You know, I've watched 17 products.
I mean, it could be fun. I mean, that might surprise me.
The point is, if you look at the whole, I mean, I can't go through them in turn, and there are some where I'm out of step with public opinion. Like, I didn't like the last Spider-Man film. I'm willing to admit that, like, the weight of public opinion is that film was good, so fair enough. But if you look at what I liked, I quite liked WandaVision with caveats, but I liked it. I quite liked Falcon and Winter Soldier. I must say, it was a bit par. It was a bit like fairly standard stuff, but I liked it. I liked a lot of them in terms of I enjoyed them well enough when I watched it, but how many do I think were objectively good? I quite liked Doctor Strange. Wakanda Forever was massively hamstrung. They couldn't really do much about that, to be fair. But you're looking at three or four products in the whole phase that I thought were any good. And that's now 18 products because we've started phase 5. But I go in every time, like, quite hopeful, because I think at some point they've got enough credit in the bank, although they're eating it away really fast, to go, well, they got this right for fucking, what was it, 11 years? They got this right for 11 years, and they still get bits of it right. So presumably, if they were to throttle back, involve Kevin Feige more hands-on again, properly, throttle back on as much product and put a bit more quality control in it, then maybe we'd find our way back. I don't know.
I don't know. I think Endgame felt like a definitive conclusion. I think now we're just treading water.
You sometimes see it in, they're victims of their own success. A, because at the end of Endgame they must have gone big exhale, and A, we did it, and B, what on earth do we do now? And you sometimes see it in, silly example, you sometimes see it in sport, and this will be germane to the next film I raise. You see it in boxing. You see guys who fight for years to get to the top, and then they come in overweight and lose in their first defence. Some people are just, they're better scaling the mountain than they are keeping themselves at the top of it. That they get there and go, I've done it all now. And I do wonder if that's the case with Marvel, that they just sort of don't have the, subconsciously they don't have the sort of stomach for rebuilding, and so they've sort of defaulted to formula.
Yeah.
That, like, this is vaguely how you do it. There's too much of it is the bottom line, that this was a healthier set of franchises when it was like a couple of films a year. But there you go. But talking of boxing, Creed 3.
Yeah, so this is quite a continuation for the Rocky series that we did. I thought it was all right. I quite enjoyed it. I thought it was fine. I don't think it was as good as the last two movies, quite frankly. But I do think there was that Michael B. Jordan had some talent behind the camera as well. Going forward, so, but I don't know, I kind of think the series is now done now. I can't really see any more beyond this, though. What do you think?
Did you see it, Becca?
No, I didn't in the end, unfortunately. No, I missed it.
Maybe we will do it later on. Maybe we'll do it one day, just because the Rocky series is possibly one of the strongest series we've done. So for completeness,
maybe when it comes out on home release,
maybe. There's no pressure on it, but like if it finds itself on Netflix, which we all have, for example, then maybe we will say, just as an aside, let's do this. I don't feel a need, for example, to catch up on 17 Marvel products. We did the Infinity Saga, and that's fine. I'm not saying.
Would you guys recommend Creed
3? Yeah, I mean, let's get the headline out of the way. It's not at all a bad film. I think the problem is that I wanted them to stop after Creed, and then I really wanted them to stop after Creed 2. And that's almost in my best interest rather than what I really want. Sometimes you think, it's like when you want the backstory on a character, but you know it's bad news for you to get it. It's like sometimes you can know too much. And I felt like that about the Rocky series. By all means, keep making them. I'll lap them up like boxing films. Great. But I knew in reality that Creed 2 was far, far better than a sequel was ever likely to be. It should have been. It was also better than a sequel that had the Drago characters in it was ever likely to be. Because I honestly thought, shit, they're going to go straight to Rocky 4 and this is going to be cartoonish shit. It had real heart. I think, you know, the only sequel that comes anywhere near it, really, is Rocky 2. and I think it would probably sit just a bit better than that as well. So I really liked it. And then they said they were going to bring it back. No Sly. Well, on the one hand, I can live with it. But on the other hand...
Is this the first Rocky film without Sylvester?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I sometimes feel I've got mixed feelings.
Well, isn't it? It's not a Rocky film, it's Creed. But...
No, it's part of the Rocky franchise, and that's fine. But I've got mixed feelings on it, on that. In that, on the one hand, he doesn't own the character, right? So when he's complaining, I want a share, it's like, you've known the deal now for nearly 50 years. But on the other hand, I think, well, if he's really fallen out with them, that's a shame. Because they made something special together, and his performances in the last two Rocky films have been better than anything since his first entry, really. Maybe the second one, actually, because I did like him trying to do the adverts and Smeal mainly. Forget the fact that that was a funny joke. It's the fact that the man was humiliated in front of his wife and he played that well, and then he's trying to read to her and things like that. That's actually acting with real heart.
Sure.
So, but then he went through the sort of Superman era of look at my muscles, and I just thought the series shit the bed, to be honest with you. But I'm talking a long way around this, but there's only really one. I don't think it's objectively the worst in the series, as you can go back and listen to all our reviews to find that. But the only entry in the series that hasn't been fun, really, was Rocky V. Rocky IV, I don't think it's a particularly good film, but I can't deny it's quite fun. And the recut version that came out last year is better, much better. Still the same film with the same flaws, but it's better. Better cuts. And if you go on Amazon Prime at the moment, there's Keep Punching, which is an hour-long documentary about the recutting of Rocky IV, and it's worth watching. Because it really lets you into his thinking. He went in to just do a bit of tweaking and ended up in this really long process, but he's even changing the angles of shots and explaining why, and punches, and he's going, you should never show a punch from that angle, and he shows why, and he explains why, and it's really, it shows you what a thoughtful filmmaker he is. But anyway.
That's one of the things, isn't it? Like, if you start sort of fiddling, and then it kind of goes from there, really, doesn't it? So it's a bit of a slippery slope.
But the point is, though, the Rocky series has been fun, even at its worst. And Creed 3 continues that. But I just remember seeing a trailer to it, and it's this sort of thing from his childhood. And I'm like, I can see what you're going to try to do there. You're going to try to peel back more layers of the Adonis character. But at the same time, what you're going to tell me is this guy is your age, if not older, and you're going to be close to retirement. He won't have had a professional career. He'll just be out of prison, which tells me this is going to be a bit of a Cape Fear sort of deal, which is thematically interesting, but as a boxing movie, this carries no weight and makes no sense at all. I would expect a boxer retired for fucking 5 years to beat somebody on a pro debut, or at least their second fight, no matter how talented they were as teenagers. So the whole sort of boxing angle of it was a bit, so what? The boxing scenes, I could see what he was trying to do. They were almost getting inside each other's heads and remembering abuse as kids. But it took away that essential reality of fights that we've had in the recent series, where they've almost made it like an HBO stroke DAZN stroke Showtime presentation. HBO don't do boxing anymore, by the way. So they can't do that anymore. It's mainly sort of Showtime DAZN over there. But and we see both of those, I think. It's technically very proficient. He's very good in the role. Again, it's almost the erroneous complaint people put at Skyfall, because he started late as a boxer. He's suddenly an old man. Now Bond wasn't an old man in boxing. See the Skyfall in Skyfall. See the Skyfall review for my argument on that. But it is we've skipped a lot, and the timeline is screwy because Creed 2 was 2018. And yet we see him unify the title and retire in 2017. We're 4 years on from that, but his daughter looks more like she's about eight. So All of that's a bit screwy. But it lives in the real world. Just things like he was undisputed champion, but the guy who followed him is unified champion. And if you know boxing, that means different things. So he's got a number of the belts, but not all of them. No one looks like a heavyweight. I always find that hilarious because the leading man's not very big. The guy who's replaced him as heavyweight looks like a fucking welterweight.
Stop getting boxing wrong.
It's all right. And it feels sort of like a Rocky film. It's at once quite innovative, but it's also quite repetitive. We spend far too much time in this sort of den area of his house where there's a full-length picture. It was one of the posters from Creed 2. behind him on the wall. He's got, and the belt, he's got like a cabinet with all his belts in, and they are the real belts. That I recognize those belts. That is the WCBC belt, IBF, WBA, WBO, Ring Magazine belts. I recognize all of those belts and what bodies they're from. Right beside that is a full length sort of black and white picture of him, and it's, if you go and see our Creed 2 review on YouTube, it's that picture. And there's a little bar beside it where, you know, they'll have, I think there's a lot of product placement in this film. They drink a lot of Hennessy and they sit around and have a lot of their conversations in that room, and it makes the film look visually repetitive because they're either there or at the gym. But it's a decent story, decently told. And what I will say is, current legal issues notwithstanding, if those do go away, Jonathan Majors is a massive star waiting to happen.
I was going to say, it's another Jonathan Majors film, isn't it? Definitely. Mm. Yeah. He seems to be kind of like, his star is definitely on the rise.
He's Mike Tyson-ish in that Mike Tyson...
and Sean Connery, though.
Mike Tyson was intimidating, but then you'd interview him and he's very softly spoken with quite a high lisp of a voice. And Jonathan Majors, I'm not saying he's got a high voice, but he's very softly spoken in the film, and he's very physically sort of gentle, except when he's in the ring, where he's all fouls, which Tyson was as well. Plenty of films where he's trying to break, plenty of fights where he's trying to break people's arms and stuff.
It doesn't like he got, yeah, if you sort of met him to an interview, you'd be like, oh my God, is he going to thump me in the face? But he might
but
be
no,
lovely.
You don't actually get that air from him. He's And we sort of, we jump a bit, he's suddenly champion and he's got this massive home, and then it's straight onto the rematch. And I think the film misses a bit and then just takes too long over the last act. So there's a lot wrong with it. It's a three-star film.
He proper goes on to Machiavellian villain-like and then...
Yeah.
And then being like...
And it's ludicrous. It's vaguely, if you think to... I know that I'm thinking of the remake version, although I've seen both. But if you think of the Martin Scorsese Cape Fear, where he's turning up at the cinemas and just sort of haunting them a bit... That's all a bit dodgy. What I do like is the small thing I'll say. I'll say two things and then we'll move on. Or Chris can say more, whichever we want to do. If Creed was a 5-star film, Creed 2 was a 4-star film, this is a 3-star film. So it is diminishing returns. I've said a lot about the sort of thematic ideas of the film. What I will say is one little plus I like is Rocky 3, he beats Clubber Lang. We never see Clubber Lang again. In the Rocky series, he beats Drago in 4, and through the rest of the Rocky films, the ones with Rocky in the name, it's like he never existed. Here we do see Victor Drago again, and we do see Tony Bellew's character, Ricky Conlon, again. It's a living, breathing boxing world. I mean, if when Usyk beat Anthony Joshua last year, Anthony Joshua didn't just disappear. He's fighting again this weekend. He's still a contender. He's still in and around it. You would still see him at award events and things like that. You'd still see him popping up on things to give opinions. The idea that, like, it isn't one loss and you disappear off the face of the earth, and it does actually have a boxing scene that's living and breathing. That's the one plus I can give it. I will say Bianca's still a bit wasted. She's going down the... Although she's never complained about him fighting in the same way that Adrian did, she's a bit sidelined because of the hearing loss. Her sort of career is sidelined. And so she's kind of standing around in shots and just observing this relationship between two boys. She's there to try to get Adonis to get in touch with his feelings, which he's refusing to do. But again, we're recycling a little bit here that we've had Donnie come to term with.
It's a little bit Rocky 3, Rocky 5, isn't it? A little bit. Kind of like sort of cross, it kind of merges the two together.
Yeah, it's all right, you know?
I suppose to Sly, I'll be honest, it kind of felt right that he wasn't in the film, at least initially. I think the only time where I thought, right, Sly, this is where Sly would come in naturally, just as a, from a storytelling perspective.
He should have been there from the camp onwards.
From what? Sorry,
the training camp onwards. What I'm saying is, if Sylvester Stallone was in it, but you decided to experiment with less of him, if he said, like, you can have me for a week or something, most of that film, given that he's Philadelphia-based, his wife's grave's there, his best friend, quote unquote, because Paulie and him had a different.
And his son, who's just reconnected.
And he's got his son in Canada, so he's either going to be in Philadelphia or Canada. One of the two. The idea that he's not hanging around in LA at Adonis' house is absolutely fine. But when it comes to
I kind of expect that as well. I don't think he'd always be there. Do you know what I mean? No. Like, because I think they'd have both have moved on.
And the only time Duke's son trained him was in the first Drago fight, which didn't go well. So it's not overly clear in the Ricky Conlan undisputed fight. Again, everyone's a blown up light heavyweight. Sly could have been there and we didn't see him. You don't know. It doesn't really matter. I guess it doesn't matter. The film doesn't massively miss him, but again, it feels a bit forced. It's a bit of force something that happened years ago we've never thought about and bring it back as an issue.
Initially, it felt right. So, like the last third or fourth of the movie, that let's just say there is a funeral. I'm not going to spoil it. There is a funeral, and you think Rocky would be there. You know, Rocky would turn up at that thing, and you think there'll be a scene at least.
Particularly
with, like...
as he was, without trying to give too much away, he was knocked for his lack of interest in the family in the decades after Apollo had died. Therefore, another bereavement in Donnie's life, regardless of who and how.
He'd be there. And there was just the what's his name, Duke's son, is it Duke or
it is, it's Tony Jr. I think Duke Evans. So
he kind of gives him like the closing prep talk, you know, and the last round kind of thing, and to me that just felt a bit odd. I thought, no, that's probably Rocky. I should have been Rocky. That it just in that moment it just felt like that needs to be like a, you know, it felt a bit odd. That the only thoughts on like Sly not being there. But I rather enjoyed it. I mean, a few plot holes aside, but yes, like with his mum not pointing out.
What's concerning is they're now talking. Yeah, there's things his mother didn't say. There's lots that people did not say.
You
to
tell me that now before we just want to.
Yeah. I thought it was all a little bit forced, and we also had a spell where Rocky was losing somebody every film, and it was like, what pain can I concoct for Rocky in this film? And it felt a bit like that. And then I read that Jordan is meeting with studio executives to map out a film and television franchise for this world, and it's like, how many times are we going to go to the well here? Now, I could have said that after Rocky 4, really. Could have said it after Rocky 5. Certainly could have said it after Rocky Balboa, because you think, yes, you did come back and push your luck, but you tied it off quite nicely. We could have said it after Creed. You know, continually this series proves us wrong, but this just felt like, not a step too far in that it was a bad film, but a step too far in that you had two outstanding Creed entries, and now you've got quite an ordinary one.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. I think now's the time to. I can't see. You never know. It'll probably take Sly to come back to do something, maybe. But at the moment, I'm thinking, call it a day now.
Whilst I thought he tried a bit too hard on the boxing scenes, you can see he's got flair. He might need to rein it in a bit, but he's actually got quite a flair director. There was parts where he was visually a bit. Not lacking in innovation, like I say, far too many rooms in that sort of snug in the house, and too busy a camera and cuts and ideas in the fight. But balance those out with a bit more experience, because he's a young director, he's got a future, definitely. And lack vanity as well, you know, the character was told you're too old, and actually in boxing terms he is. Because Michael B. Jordan is the character's probably 37 now. So yeah, although this was shot during this felt a bit, again, it was 3 years after retirement. Every indication was this film was shot set in 2020, but just ignore that, assume it was this year. The only other, before we get to sort of our second main event, which is the film we were going to do the show on. Just two films to mention. I saw Empire of Light. That was in and amongst all the...
Oh, yeah, that was a lovely film.
Is that on Disney Plus, Becca?
I've seen
it streaming. I think it was on there. I sat and watched it one afternoon. It was Olivia Colman. Now, Olivia Colman is always great.
She's currently here in England in the BBC. You've got a new adaptation of Great Expectations, which is partially filmed in Salisbury. It's a very different adaptation, but she's fantastic.
For those struggling to place her, she was the queen in series seasons 3 and 4 of The Crown, which I haven't got to.
Yeah, I think that's where, especially our overseas audience.
She's also going to be in Secret... Talking of Marvel, she's going to be in Secret Invasion. I only read that today. She's going to be in that, as is... What's her name from Game of Thrones and Terminator Genesis?
Oh, wow. It's going to be amazing.
Oh, yeah.
I'm blanking on her name. We know who we mean.
Yeah, Lena...
No, not Lena Headey.
All right.
The one who played you're right, because you're thinking of Terminator Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Yeah,
no,
yes.
Terminator Genesis.
Oh yes, so her.
About 15 years younger than Lena Headey. I'm trying to think of her name now. It will come to us, or one of us will look it up. She was Targaryen Daenerys in Game of Thrones. Anyway, she's going to be in it too. But Empire of Light is set in 1980. It's another film sort of set in and around film and the cinema.
They're that and The Fablemans, and they're kind of films about films and filmmaking.
Yeah, actually, to put the film into, like, it runs across 1980 and 81, because in 81 they get the regional premiere. It's set in Margate, which is a sort of coastal seaside touristy town in Kent.
And they use, like, the actual cinema there, don't they? Except a friend of mine from the JBR community lives in the area, and said he often saw the director or Roger Deakins.
The entranceway reminded me of the cinema from Inglourious Bastards.
Big massive deco cinema.
Yeah, very sort of art deco cinema. And actually, the film is building up to a regional premiere of Chariots of Fire, the director of which died a few weeks ago. Chariots of Fire is one of those sort of early 80s British films that sort of, along with Merchant Ivory, got a lot of Oscar attention. It's actually about the 1924 Olympics. I don't know if
anyone also features in The Crown, because it turns out that Alfie son financed it.
I've not got that far with The Crown yet, although it's hard to do spoilers in The Crown because it's talking about our own history, so I'm not worried about that. But
it pops up.
Hugh Hudson was the director of it, but it's all about that. It's Olivia Colman who's sort of
Miriam Dobber.
She's got, like, is she bipolar or something like that? Schizophrenic.
Yeah,
she's got mental health issues,
hasn't she?
And she's having an affair with the manager of the place, who's played by married man played by Colin Firth. But she gets friendly with a young black man who's working there, and he's taken a lot of, because it is the era of, like, DM boots and skinheads.
And that sort of thing.
So she's taken a lot of racial abuse, and it's just about that. And the story's less important. Now, the funny thing is, I saw Olivia Colman film last year that bored the living shit out of me and got a lot of praise. Not everything she does is gold, but she's always gold in it. I'm just going to look up that film. It was about a woman on holiday somewhere. I'm trying to think. I'll come to it in a minute. But this film's worth seeing, and it's another one that's on Disney Plus. The film I saw last year is... No, I can't find it now.
Oh,
it's The Lost Daughter. I didn't like that film.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
I didn't like it, but to each their own.
She's also in a very early David Tennant episode of Doctor Who, like before she was famous.
Oh, she was in an early episode of Ricky Gervais's Office.
She was.
Looking a lot younger there. Because she is she is my generation, but she's like 2 or 3 years older than me, something like that. She was also in the Netflix version of A Christmas Carol that just came out recently. If you want to see her in a film...
That was quite good, actually. I enjoyed that.
A film I absolutely loved and reviewed for Set the Tape years ago. I'd only been writing for them a few months, was The Favourite. She was in that with...
That's such a brilliant film.
She was Queen Anne. She was that with Emma Stone. And I really, really liked that film. And Mrs. Daniel Craig was in it as well.
Rachel Weisz.
Rachel Weisz. That's a bit unfair because Rachel Weisz has had a career of her own. I was just blanking on the name for a minute.
Hugh Hudson was like Mr. Miriam Darbo.
Just as completely random aside, I tried to download it the other day, but didn't have enough time.
I was
looking for films, and I think we've just been talking about Ant-Man, which is a poor
film. No, I'm joking,
film,
don't worry.
And we've just been talking about Paul Reiser. There was a film with him and Gretchen Mol in 2003 called The Shape of Things, which started as a stage play. It's fantastic.
Check out
The Shape of Things. It's really good. But they're Rachel Weisz is in that with Paul Rudd. But anyway, the last film I want to talk about before we get to the absolute main event is Shazam Fury of the Gods. Have we seen that?
Shazam? I haven't seen that, no.
Another the first superhero film that tanked. Oh, yeah, great.
I don't know too much about it. So I went in, I saw the first film. I kind of went in a little bit blind because I didn't know anything about the series at all. I probably should go and see it because I tried to kind of see like a, obviously, Liverpool was in the series, but like a broad church of films and that sort of thing, but I've just got no compunction to go and see the sequel. I don't know if I should, or I'm just kind of a little bit like, meh. If I do, I do. If I don't, I don't.
Chris, what did you think?
I haven't seen it.
Ah, all right. Well, just very quickly then, so we can move on to the last thing we were going to talk about for half hour. I must admit, there are films that come out sometimes that I just don't see what everyone else sees. You know, you'll suddenly start reading these amazing reviews, and when you go, it's not even that it's bad, it's not even that you hate it, you just go and see it and you go, well, that was bang ordinary, what's everyone raving about? The Lost Daughter was an example, actually, that got lots of raves, and it got tons and tons of raves, and I couldn't see why. And Shazam was one of those. I went to see it, and it was okay. It felt like a very standard superhero film. I think the trouble is, because DC had made so much shit, I think when they make something competent, there's a tendency to overpraise it. I thought it was all right. I know it hasn't been the case for a lot of years now, but there was a spell when he did it all the time. I'm sick of Mark Strong as a fucking villain. I just think it's a waste of his talent.
Yeah, he's a bit stereotyped, isn't he?
It's too much. But, I mean, he did it in Robin Hood. He did it in Green Lantern. He did it in... there was others.
Yeah, he's definitely been sort of stereotyped a little bit, hasn't he?
But yeah, he's done a lot of them, it suffice to say. And I thought it was bang ordinary. And of course, forget what's in the comics, this is a different medium. And of course, the whole family becoming Shazam's, you know, characters at the end, it's like, well, no one's going to be special in the next film, are they? Because if everyone's special, no one is. You know, the character, it's either about him or it's about a family. It can't really be both. So we went into this film, and the best I can say about it is it's fine. I think Helen Mirren's a wonderful actress, but she bears all the hallmarks of someone not even remotely understanding the script. She sort of, she just looks like something that's not made for her generation, and that she's saying all the words, but you just go in, you've got no idea what you're saying here, have you? And, you know, you go
just showing up for the paycheck.
I don't even think it's phoning it in, but I don't want to say she's lost anything because she hasn't. She's still great. And she will be great in Fast 11 or 10 or whatever it is when she appears, because she actually likes the films and gets them. I watched her in Hitchcock last night because my wife loves Hitchcock. We're doing Hitchcock soon. And the Anthony Hopkins film about him is on Disney Plus. So we watched that last night.
Is it? Oh, my God. Literally.
Did you not know that?
No, I've literally been under a rock this week.
Hitchcock has always been on there.
I popped up to watch John Wick, and that was about it.
No, Hitchcock has been in my Disney Plus queue forever. I saw it at the cinema. It's a 2012 film, and Helen Mirren plays his wife, Alma.
After you've seen the film,
yeah,
pick up Stephen Rebello's book, Alfred Hitchcock, The Making of Psycho, because that's what it's based on. And it's completely different. The film, it's fantastic.
Right. Okay.
Sorry, we'll get there. We'll get there.
Send me a link. Send me a link.
Great performances.
Put a link in the chat.
The book is completely different.
She went, he's playing really well, because she loves Anthony Hopkins, is like her favorite actor as well. And she said, that looks like Anthony Hopkins. And I said,
it is.
And she said, oh wow. And then a few minutes later, when she saw how different his voice was, she said, he's playing this really well. And I said,
yeah, he does it really well, doesn't he?
And I said, have you ever heard Alfred Hitchcock? And she said, no, I don't think I have. So I immediately found him on, like, the Dick Cavett Show or something.
Yeah, I've got that on DVD. It's fantastic.
And I played a clip of it, and she went, oh, my God.
Literally, so, I don't know if she's ever seen Alfred Hitchcock Presents, obviously, but his half-hour TV show.
Yeah, and the film is very like that. He talks to the camera, yeah. Yeah, that's how he does the introduction to the film.
Yeah.
But Scarlett Johansson is Janet Leigh.
Literally, I could send you like my personal library.
Beale is Jessica Beale is Vera Miles. So there's someone in it playing the guy who does look quite a lot like Anthony Perkins and so on.
James somebody or other. He's really good, yeah. But he's not in it very much.
Anyway, the point is, we were watching that last night, and I've forgotten what my point is. What the hell was I talking about Hitchcock for?
Because your wife wanted to see it.
Yeah, I know. But what was my point about? What was
I don't
my
know,
point?
But I can highly
Helen Mirren. Sorry, Helen Mirren was in that. But what I'm saying is, I can see plenty of examples of great work from Helen Mirren. She's far from past.
She's amazing.
but she just isn't quite right in this film. And you got Lucy Liu beside her as her sister, which is odd. But anyway, that's all fine.
Yeah, how is it? Yeah, I'm not too sure, but the casting of the film seems a bit off. So I'm a little bit like,
The family go off to do superhero things together. And of course, most of the attributes of Shazam, you know, the strength of Hercules, the wisdom of this and so on, they don't really have. I mean, where they've got the fucking wisdom, I don't know. There's still some funny lines in it. Nothing as funny as when he was talking across to Mark Strong in the air and they couldn't hear each other, which is something superhero films never think of. I remember when we were watching Age of Ultron and they're chatting to each other in busy traffic and stuff like that, and I was going, they just talk at normal volume, and that film called it out.
It's like, we can't hear you.
But it's really unfocused. It's okay. That's all I can say about it. No surprise it's bombed. It's just nothing special. And I think what's not... I'll be very interested to see what The Flash does, because I think there's got to be an undercurrent of... Normal casual moviegoers probably don't know this stuff, and they either like the first one and remember it, or they don't. But you've got to remember, the first one's pre-COVID. Even though it's only 4 years, it's been a long 4 years, so might feel a long time ago to people now.
Also with The Flash, you've got the TV series too.
But the dedicated filmgoers who know this stuff will know this stuff might be about to be written out of experience. Honestly, though, if you went in and watched this film, you would honestly think Freddy was the lead character. So it's really like, whose perspective is this from? The CG is dreadful. The CG is like, I don't know what's happened to Hollywood. I don't know if there's just too few studios making too much stuff. Because they're now, increasingly TV shows can afford to have CG as well. So maybe the workload and video game studios and all the rest of it, maybe the workload's gone up, but skies don't even look real now. It all looks fucking garbage, honestly. It's not as good as the first
That's
one.
That's like
but
your trailer for this. Garbage.
It's not as good as the first one. It's not terrible. I didn't love the first one either. Those are the headlines, folks.
News headlines Lovely. From Dave.
Lovely. The only thing I've not seen it. The only thing I will say is I watched Scream 6.
Yeah, I saw that.
I haven't seen it because I haven't seen Scream 5.
Yeah,
you got to check it out. It came out last year.
Oh, it's on it's on Paramount Plus, which I have, but I don't tend to gravitate towards horror, although I've seen all the Scream films. Although I will say just very quickly.
I reckon we should do them.
I honestly believe Scream to be the single most overrated franchise of my lifetime.
Even more reason to do it. Do it.
Well,
Do it.
Go on, Chris.
I was going to say... I've got to say I was very disappointed in it. And it's a shame because there were parts of it that I really did like. I liked the new setting in New York. I liked how violent some of it was. Like, it was actually quite shocking. Like, oh wow, that really did hurt.
I think it's probably one of the goriest. Like, there's one particular death scene towards the end of the film. No spoilers, but it's quite bloody, isn't it? Oh my god!
But it has no teeth. Like, at the end of the day, because it does hold the whole thing of like, these are the rules now, and now everyone's life is forfeit, mm-hmm. and even legacy characters. And it's like, well, okay, but you don't utilize any of them. I mean, I won't spoil anything.
It still tries to be quite meta, doesn't it? It tries to kind of like out-meta
itself. Yeah, but it's like, but mild spoiler, no one like important actually dies, there's no one outstanding from the last film that buys it, even though you think they have, because
they did kill off a legacy character in the last film. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, but then
it didn't really have an impact, though, did it?
It seemed like they were going to. It was all there, like literally having their death scene, and then it's almost like, let's keep her alive. Let's have like one line of dialogue. That's
what explained the way off screen.
And it just didn't have any guts to it, and the reveal was kind of very lackluster. I thought.
I was told Scream 5 was really good. Was it?
I think parts of it were okay, but I generally, no. I don't know. I
thought it was okay, maybe 3 out of 5. It was trying to do quite a few smart things with the genre. I would say like it didn't really kind of out meta itself the way 6 did. I thought it was, because I was kind of surprised that they made the next film, to be honest. I thought it was a nice way to kind of wrap up the series. It was quite predictable. That's the thing I would say, like the last couple of films, you can kind of predict how they're going to go. You've kind of got the same sort of characters from the previous film, so you can kind of map them over, like these new characters explain about, you know, how the rules work, how they work now, what they do for legacy characters, things like that. You can kind of map them onto the original kind of story, the original sort of characters, things like that. And it's all kind of getting a bit staid and predictable, and there's only so much meta that we can take.
That was always my problem with Scream. It came out and everyone was praising how clever it was. Now, I'm not a big horror watcher, but occasionally I've watched... there's plenty of horror films I like, by the way. It's not like I hate it, but it's like... If I were to rank my favourite genres, it would be, like, flat fucking bottom. Just ahead of musicals, probably. But I'd just seen Wes Craven's New Nightmare.
Yeah.
Now, Wes Craven's New Nightmare, for me, was everything Scream was trying to do done properly.
But better.
Yeah. I always thought Wes Craven's New Nightmare was like the perfect deconstruction of a horror film, right? Whereas what Scream did was say, look how clever we are to have noticed that horror films have all these immutable rules, right? Then just fucking did them all. And it's like, well, that ain't that clever, is it? Just not. That's like She-Hulk going, it wasn't this, just shit. It's like, well, pointing it out doesn't make it any better.
No, it doesn't. And make it
I never felt it was that scary. I never felt it was that funny. I thought all the characters were fucking twats. And as the series went on, it didn't really get any better, and it just kept rinsing and repeating. And then, but it came back for 4, and a bit like when they brought Jason Bourne out, I thought, well, it's been so many years, they've probably got a great idea.
It's pretty much more of the same, isn't it? But I think that's why you've got this other character from Scream 4 back as well, which is quite interesting. But I think the way they play with their character, and also she's got a lot of traction from from Heroes fans, for example, because she was a big part of that, and that was kind of like a breakout show, certainly for us over here in the UK.
Yeah. I'm saying, yeah.
Oh, Hayden Panettiere.
Oh, yeah, she was in it, wasn't she? Heroes, sorry, I didn't hear the word Heroes. I said her
show. I do apologize.
No, you said it, I just didn't hear it.
And she's got, I kind of think, like, for me, the best thing about Scream 6 was definitely her character and kind of how they sort of play with it and play with expectations. I mean, I would agree with you, Chris. It's a bit kind of staid and very sort of predictable as well. And the reveal is very underwhelming. There are a few twists and turns that I wasn't expecting, that sort of thing.
It had a good opening. Like, the opening itself was like, oh, this is something different. Oh, what are we going to get?
Yeah, it's like Ghostface Takes Manhattan. I was like, yes, get them out of Woodsboro.
Yeah. I won't spoil anything, but the opening is like, oh, this is something different.
Well,
yeah,
I'll certainly see 5, because my wife likes it not particularly Scream. She likes horror more than I do. I know it's on there. She's sort of half expressed an interest. She's never said, let's watch it, so we've ended up with something else. If she said, let's watch it, we would. But because a lot of people keep saying 5 was actually pretty good, I might.
Yeah, 5 was half decent. Definitely check it out. I mean, it is kind of more the same, really, to be honest. It's kind of more of the same, but there are some good, you know, some good callbacks to previous films, some interesting cameos, definitely. But my main reason for, like, is obviously Psycho 2 gets a mention, and I think one of the deaths in Scream 6 is, I'm just going to put it out there, so it is a homage to that. It's not, really, that's not what it's meant to be, but for me, it is a homage to that film.
Yeah, but we like Psycho 2, me and Becca.
Definitely. So, yeah, there's one scene in Scream 6, which you'll be like, ah, we know where that's from.
I didn't know if you'd seen really it, Chris, because I don't know what you've seen, Hitchcock or Hitchcock-related.
Psycho 2 is actually surprisingly
good. When we come around to doing it, I'm going to have to do an the owls.
It really is. It really is. I like Psycho 2 a lot. And it's got Sipowicz in it, and he gets results.
And he does, with his shirt sleeves.
So I'm on about the 6th season of NYPD Blue now. Bobby Simmons just died and gutted.
But this time, he gets dead.
Yeah. Ricky Schroeder's just joined. Anyway. So, last film, I've got there's more I can sort of talk about that actually I've probably covered, but there's screeners and you won't have seen them and stuff like that. I think...
I'd like to set the tape and check out Dave's reviews.
Yeah, more's coming. I covered a very niche sort of thing on football referees recently. I mean, that's a very strange thing to sit and talk about, so we won't. The most recent thing we've all seen is John Wick. Chapter 4.
Yes.
Just to add to that. Now, I saw Becca's seen it a couple of times. Chris is about to see it a second time. I've seen it the once. We were supposed to record 3 days ago, but I actually saw it on the Sunday, which means I saw it 5 days ago.
I saw it, I think, a week today.
Yeah. I was supposed to go a week ago today, but I didn't actually get there. Well, what happened was I went to the National Marine Aquarium in Plymouth. Very near there was a Greek restaurant. I went in there and we ordered this sort of banquet thing, quite cheap. But all this food turned up and I had a couple of beers and I was sweating from the food and I was thinking, I ain't going to do a 3-hour film, forget it. I'm going to go home and have a drink.
I
went on Sunday morning, came home and wrote it up immediately. I basically wrote a review, went to the cinema, came home and wrote a review, basically, because I'd done a DVD for a film called Women of Twilight the day before, which had Lois Maxwell in it, by the way.
Yeah, 52. I'm looking forward to reading your review of that, because that's quite a controversial film for the time, dealing with like unmarried women and things like that.
It was Britain's first X-rated film.
It was, yes. As you say, very much pre-Bond, pre-Anderson,
It is the societal attitudes of the time that are interesting. But what it is, I saw a 3-hour film, I had to come back, and I didn't have time to let it settle at all. But I must say, fortunately, 5 days on, my opinion about it hasn't changed. I'm going to start with two small complaints. One of them doesn't bother me very much. One, I think, was a fundamental mistake for the series. And then it is going to be a torrent of praise because I loved it. Two small ones. One doesn't bother me, but again, a bit like we'd said this with Iron Man. Iron Man started as realistic but science fiction-y as you can imagine. And then it ended with him falling thousands of miles and his fall being broken by the Hulk. I mean, that would just, your body would be liquid. Now, John Wick's falls have got ever more ridiculous. So we've now come to this point that he's...
somebody leaping out the window on
it
fire.
It doesn't bother me, but towards the end of the film, he falls down so many steps. It's crunching, but it's just pushing it a bit.
I think he falls down all 222 steps of the Sacré-Cœur, doesn't he, I think?
Even he gets to the point where he's just stopped. He's like, oh, there's that bit. Then he's like, oh, no.
And then he gets the momentum.
It's very cartoony.
Yeah, because there's platforms after every few steps. So every time you think he's going to stop, his momentum just carries him onto the next load.
Yeah.
So that's kind of funny in its way. So that's a problem. But it's been such a slow stretching of reality that I can just about wear it. Because his fall at the end of John Wick 3 was ridiculous. The second problem is, I think, a bit more fundamental. Now, it's allowed them to design scenes a certain way, but I do think the bulletproof suits are a mistake. I do think the bulletproof mistake, because he's just a superhero. You know, there's a bit in the film where he's firing at guys who are in full body armor. They almost look like something out of Halo.
Yeah.
And he's firing at them. Just knock them off their feet a bit so he can focus on the other one, because it's so difficult to hurt them, because that's the upside of... The even bigger downside of him wearing a bulletproof suit is everyone going after him is wearing ever bigger armor, and it's getting silly now. But the shots on him aren't even knocking him back. You don't even notice the bullets until right at the end where he's taking the suit off, and you can hear, obviously, bullet shells hitting the floor. I think it's a fundamental mistake that he can be fired at and just lift it up like he's just trying to hide from the rain. I wish John Wick 2 had never done that. That I will say.
But it's quite funny though, like where he goes to like get the suit and then he's like, I'm going to need a gun.
But beyond that, wow. I mean, what I'll say is, just to get my first thoughts out of the way, I thought at the end of 3, I remember thinking, you're just stretching your running times just a bit much, because I think the first one was about, and we reviewed
As we noticed in our review, they get longer as they go along, don't they? And this one is the longest of the lot so far.
Well, so the first one was about, I'm from memory, and we've done reviews of all of these. Obviously, this is going to be our review of this one, unless we do decide later and we reserve the right, as with Creed on home release, to go, actually, let's add to our series and do one. But if we don't, this is our review. But we did them all a year or two ago. And I remember having praise for all of them. But I remember thinking 2 was a bit too lore heavy. But I remember it went from like an hour and 40, which was tight, lean, perfect, to maybe closer to 2 hours, I can't remember, but a bit too much bollocks in it about markers and lore. And then the third one had no extra plot, but was suddenly half an hour longer. And I just thought, this looks baggy. And the whole sequence, he goes and meets Halle Berry somewhere out in the Middle East or whatever it was. And that whole sequence got undone as soon as he came back. So it was like the film had lost its tautness. And then I see that we're having another one and it's going to be nearly 3 hours. I have major fears going into this. And then you see trailers where I can't remember if it is in the trailer, but it's certainly in the film that he's in. I mean, he was in Paris. He was in New York. He was in Berlin. He was in the Middle East. Was he in the? He was in the Far East at one point. Yeah, because he's in the Far.
Yes, it's very,
he's in the Middle East with the Elder.
Film, isn't he?
He's in, yeah, he's in Berlin to get his status back. He's in France for the final battle. He's in New York for because that's where the Con Enter is, and he's in Japan. So suddenly you're like the scope creep of this.
Yes, in the desert.
I thought this film was going to be a bloated mess. I thought it was fantastic. What about you guys?
It was still messy. It was still bloated, but it whipped by, didn't it? It really did actually whip through.
Well, the first thing I'll say is, I said this with the Matrix sequels. The less did we ever do the Matrix films? I can't remember.
No, we haven't.
No, we
I've talked about them incidentally. That the more dialogue you give Keanu,
should we add them to the list?
Is that, yeah. But the point I'm making is with Keanu is I always said bad actor, but a bit like Arnold, I've come to appreciate him. What he is an outstanding physical actor. Even facially, he can do it all.
I won't hear a word against him.
He has been given 380, he's done 380 words in this film, and apparently it was Keanu himself who kept striking through dialogue and saying, I don't need to say that. And his instincts are correct, because the less he can say...
He doesn't say very much, does he?
The better. He needs to say some stuff. We've got to, you know, advance plot and things and have him express feelings about some things, but the...
He says so much when he's like, you know, are you ready? And he goes like, yeah. Or like, I'm going to need a gun. Like, he can do so much with just a look or the way he positions himself.
It's something about the stoic hero that just sort of doesn't say much, isn't it? That's basically what the...
Yeah, it's basically similar, you know, to our Western series, Blondie or The Man With No Name, pretty much. He just
but not having him say much is for the best, right? But the action sequences, I mean, the one in Osaka is probably about par for the series. If you in your mind go, what is an extended John Wick action sequence like? It's like that. It goes through multiple environments, and it's got one of two phases to it. It's either him in one place with waves attacking him that he has to fight off, or it's him trying to fight through people to get to a goal. And it normally goes through a few different environments, lit a different way and soundtracked a different way. It's about par for the series. What I was always getting fed up with, and it was at its worst in the second one, was the use their body weight against them, quick flick over, two bullets in the head. By film four, that's getting repetitive. But from there, we've just got such a range of sequences. The whole Berlin thing, I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, realistic. I mean, they are having life or death battles around people dancing in a nightclub who are just not, you know, limbs are coming off and they're just continuing to dance.
Yeah, that was amazing, wasn't it? I think, I sent you a link to Kermode's review for Kermode and Mary's Take, and it just basically, the whole thing, it's quite like a big dance because they're all dancing around him, and the whole sequence itself is actually quite balletic.
But it is a ballet. But then you've got the other two sequences I want to quickly point to is there's a sequence that is shot eyes view. I think this is Berlin. They're going through a pretty derelict old house. And we've got the ceiling view, if you like. So we've got the dividing bit between rooms, and everything is, it's all kind of, I don't suppose it is, but as a middle-aged man, the first thought to mind is techno. It's got a very techno-y like soundtrack.
Techno.
And it's just a ballet of him going in and out of different rooms, and it's just matching the music, and it's just perfect. Then you've got a sequence on the Arc de Triomphe fighting while traffic is... Well, first off, they're driving against traffic, but then it becomes a full-on fight where they're using, like, cars against each other.
That's in the big house. So isn't that in France as well? I'm pretty sure.
I thought that was Berlin.
Yeah. Oh, it might have been.
Yeah, they're both Paris.
Okay, fair enough. Again, this is a week ago now. And one goes... They go from one place to the next anyway. And then, of course,
it moves along really
finally,
well.
You've got a hurt John Wick, because basically it's going to be a duel at dawn, but from... evening the night before, they call out, every assassin comes at him in a wave, so he's got to stay alive till dawn basically, and he takes quite a bit of damage, and eventually he's got to fight his way up. What are the stairs called, Becca? Steps?
Oh no, it's just to the Sacré-Cœur. There's like 222 steps,
right? It's that staircase, if you like, steps. And those are just, I've just named three. well, four with the nightclub, incredibly distinctive action sequences that we haven't really seen anywhere else in the series. Well, we've seen the nightclub one is closest to something we've seen before, because we've certainly seen sequences in big social gatherings where people are almost not paying attention, but everything else is like,
oh, here we go, to the stairs of the Rue Foyer. So I don't do French, unfortunately.
Okay, where is it?
It's basically going up to the forecourt of the Sacre Coeur in Montmartre in France. It's about sort of 200, 300 odd steps, apparently, and it's called, like, Stairs of the Rue Foyer. I can't pronounce it. But it's a famously long staircase leading up to the church.
Short of doing a full review of this film, I thought that the accoutrements of the sort of lore were just that. They just helped us tell the story. Like when they're choosing how they're going to fight and where they're going to fight, the fact that they flip over these glass cards, that's just part of the lore that we don't need explained. We have a recall to markers and how they work, but that's not important. The idea of a duel, yeah, they've pulled that out of their arse a bit, but we all know what a duel is. We are familiar with the high table, but if you've not seen a previous film, you can just think of it as the assassin's governing body, right? All of those
in charge.
Yeah, that is all of that.
We know,
the Continental, the idea of it being a place of sanctuary is kind of explained again, and they have regionals. That's fine. So everything the film needs to tell you, it explains you without having to give you a load of pseudo masonry, which I think was the biggest flaw in, I think it was film two that was worse for it, but that's from memory. I haven't seen them all for a while. So all of the lore was there as decoration to the film and kind of an explanation for why they wear such gorgeous suits and accoutrements and everything else. And then the rest of it is just a straightforward balls-to-the-wall actioner, framed by the fact that it now has a budget of double what the original film did, so they can go everywhere. Not too much dialogue for Keanu. He has done a deal with the devil because the guy doesn't age. The action is ever more crunchy.
He is Dorian Gray.
Now, a lot of people have complained about the Marquis character, and actually, I almost don't. It's the only bit of my review that.
Which character, sorry? The
Marquis, the Bill Sarsgaard character. A lot of people said.
He's
or
he's
Marquis.
Quite good, but I kind of feel he's a bit like. On the first watch.
I thought he was quite menacing
he was quite
first
good.
Time.
And then when he told. Sorry, spoiled it. When he. Donnie Yen tells him to F off at the end. Everyone roared with laughter. And then the second time I watched it, I thought, actually, he's a bit of a knob. And I kind of thought, oh, he's,
yeah, the only thing I would say is he's arguably a little bit too young. I think they could have done with having someone a little bit older with a bit more gravitas. But where the physical size of the guy and what they dress him in and the locations they put him in, all absolutely gorgeous. I think that will do for me for a minute, Chris. What do you want to say about the film?
Yeah, I mean, kind of same. I thought I really enjoyed it. I kind of want to watch it again, just to kind of get really a grip to where it sits. How the whole series sort of sits, really, because this is kind of like, well, this is it for now. I don't know if they're going to do a fifth one. They might do, given
there's enough. There is some ambiguity at the end.
Yeah, there is some leeway, but you could.
But it is just leeway. I wouldn't even call it ambiguity. He clearly fell down dead. You are exploiting the fact. I'll tell you what it is. It's not even that we don't see the body, because we sort of do. It's two things. It's John saying, "Will you take me home?" Strange way to word it. But it's also when
he says to Vincent,
"Do you think he's in heaven or hell?" And Vincent looks at him and says, "Who knows?"
As in, yeah, who knows where he is?
Who knows where he is? That could be read as at a push.
Mm. Mm. I mean, yeah. I mean, to be honest, at first, initially, I just thought he just sort of like was just knackered.
Or somewhere in between. He's having sleep.
Like, yeah, he's had a bit of a day.
he does have quite the day, doesn't
it? It could have been that, but it's just the fact that, like, visions of his wife and, like, he's finally going to join her.
Well, yeah, that scene that she has that he has with his wife, is it a callback? Is it, has he actually died and is reunited with her?
No, he's not been reunited. It's just like you see it's what's etched on his heart at the point of death.
It's
I think
just a
memory. What I'm saying is, he would, it could plausibly continue. But we know they're exploiting the leeway if they do.
Yeah, and I think that's the best way to end it there. I think, like last film, it's picked up on the action. They've really gone all in.
I think it's the best action of all the films. Do you?
Yeah. I want to watch it a second time just to kind of.
All right. Is that your gut feeling?
I think it's. I don't know if it's. But I think I'm torn between in terms of action. Mm. Like the action scenes in themselves. I don't know if it's better than the last one or not, but it's kind of like.
I haven't seen three for a long time since we reviewed it.
And it's a lot bigger, obviously, and it goes all in on the camp. So I kind of feel like this film particularly is just almost like a big almost celebration of action cinema. Like they literally gone like, yeah, let's just go all in. Let's have all these like crazy ideas, all these crazy characters, and all these themes, and just like let's just like pull out the most insane shit we can come up with. Like, you know, and that's the kind of the joy of it, really. If I have a criticism, and I think we said this last time on the third film, is that the plot kind of goes a bit skew if. I don't know quite where we are with the plot. Does it make sense? Do we care? I don't know. I'm not sure.
That's what I mean. Do we care? Is it important?
Is it? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess what's important is mostly the themes. I noticed there was a line that goes across the entire series, which is consequences.
Yeah, literally, especially this fourth one as well.
The consequences. His mind has changed, has started to turn to how he'll be remembered. I mean, Sharon dies early in the film. We won't make too much of that because that'll date this episode because we're quite close to the death of Lance Reddick, who played him.
Yeah, very sad.
Which was unexpected as well. But Sharon dies in the film. And at the grave,
we need to put a spoiler alert.
He's talking about how Winston is talking to him about how he struggled to find the right word for Sharon, and he was trying to talk about loyalty and what the man did in his life. And then he went for a friend because that's what he was first and foremost. And then he said, "Loving husband." He said, "That's what I want on mine."
Yeah.
He's already turning to like the end. His
loving wife,
all the way through the film, they're talking about how there can't be a happy ending for him. Stahelski has talked about how somebody with that kind of life, isn't going to have a happy ending. So no. The film, all the way through, although it's not maudlin, it's shot through with this sort of feeling of finality, and that is the chief reason why, yes, money, it can continue plausibly, but the film is screaming we're at the end of a journey.
Yeah, I think if if it were me writing a series, not that I'm a writer at all, but I would have him, this is how I see John Wick ending. Like, it's literally just complete his mission and then just like passing on from his wounds. Just like,
yeah,
I've done what I need to do. I can rest. You know what I mean? That's kind of like the perfect way I do it for me.
The film balanced the ending very well because actually, if John Wick dies, Donnie Yen's daughter is killed. Now, you're not given enough time to care that much about the daughter, but you're given enough to care about him. And the fact that he's
spoiler alert, there is an after credit sequence. Check it out.
I'm aware of it, but I actually. By then, I just read.
Did you not see it?
No, I just read what was in it and thought, I don't need to see that.
Oh.
I know what was in it. It's
disgusting.
Like, well, I get sick of it. You see it in Marvel, right? You wait for fucking 10 minutes to see someone going next time, and that's it.
Yeah, Marvel popularised it, so now we're all kind of like
Yeah, but they're normally shit, Becca. You'd be just as well reading what's in them.
Yeah, it wasn't very much, to be honest. Exactly. I wasn't sure if there was, but we're all conditioned to it now, aren't we? We're all kind of like Pavlov's dogs, conditioned to wait around to the end of it.
So, can I just ask something? So, the Akira character at the end, is she approaching his daughter or Kane?
I read it as very like...
Or is it don't know?
Do you know what it reminded me of?
Yeah, it could be a bit of both.
It's Kill Bill Volume 1, where she kills Vanita Green. Mm. And she says to the daughter, you know, in a few years' time, you might want to look for me. You might be feeling a bit sore about it. I think that she's the grown-up Vanita Green's daughter. You know, he's killed the dad. The implication is she wants a pound of flesh back, and that might be Akira. We don't know. I don't think it's that important because I don't think it'll ever pick up because the next spin-off is going to... The next film... But the next film's going to be Ballerina, which is set between 3 and 4 anyway, so we're going back in time next. And then the Continental TV series is set during the 70s. So if there's any consequence to this, we're either not going to see it or not going to see it for years. But I mean, I thought they did the ending quite well, because when they set up, oh, we're supposed to, I've got to save my daughter, and we don't really meet the daughter, or we barely see them, that doesn't work. But they gave us enough attachment to Donnie Yen's character, who was really cool as well.
He was fantastic. I think for me, he's probably one of the best films in it.
But he didn't want to do it. He didn't want to do it, so we don't want him to suffer. And we don't want Winston to suffer, because Winston's a bit of a boy. He is like a sanitized version of the Deadwood character. He's like, he's got his own piece, and he'll run his own little cons, you know what I mean? And I just feel like he lost his friend. We don't want him to suffer, so we don't want him killed. We don't want either of them to lose. So we need some cheat, and thankfully the Kurgan came up with one. Because for those who haven't seen it, Clancy Brown's in it as the sort of sidekick of the main bad guy.
No, he's amazing there. I mean, all the cast are on top form, but I just think for me, you've got Donnie Yen, and you've got, I'm going to mangle his name, Hiroyuki Sanada, who is just an absolute legend. And to see them two sort of, you know, go at it, you know, exist on the same screen.
Yeah, we saw him in Bullet Train last year.
Amazing. But yeah, check out his back catalogue. He's incredible. He's a wonderful actor, and he's very effective, like, both in front and behind the camera as well.
Don't see the point of Lawrence Fishburne in this film. I'll just say that, though.
Oh, it's kind of like a Matrix
Yeah, I know, but it's not needed. Really kind of you could have cut him out of this film and not missed him at all.
And it's kind of, and it's a bit of a token as well, obviously, because you've got, obviously, in the first film, everyone was going on about the dog. Obviously, here you've got Mr. Nobody with his Malinois, who can kill on command, which is quite terrifying. Yeah. Beautiful dog, but very deadly tonight. And then also, because obviously, the Lawrence Fishburne character, he's got a... I'm not sure if it's Stuffy or Pitbull. It looks a bit more Stuffy this time around. But it's literally just token, and it's kind of like, well, just make more of it. You know, it's a bull-breed dog. But it's almost, as I say, you could chop him out. He has a few key scenes. But yeah, you could chop him out, definitely. But yeah, it's a little bit of a kind of a... A token admission there.
But I would.
It's nice to see the dog again.
So. I would need to rewatch, but given it's not that long ago we reviewed them, and I remembered my attitude to them all, in that I remembered I loved all of them, I was positive about all of them, but I thought three was baggy in a way that this strangely wasn't, and I felt two was too law heavy and introduced the bulletproof suits, which I fucking hate.
Yeah, not a big fan of.
This film has them, but it's difficult to get rid of them once you've introduced them. So my gut feeling, without rewatches, this falls second to the first one. Now, you might go back to the first one and find it a bit basic and short now, strangely. But at the same time, when it was released, it was perfect. And so I think they bookend each other in that you've got the most expansive one here and the tortoise one at the start.
It has a more simplistic nature to it, doesn't it? There is an art to that, like where it's like...
Yeah.
Where it's not too overblown, it's just, you know, it
is pretty much what it is, and it does what it says on the tin. It's not too heavy or baggy.
The only thing that I found frustrating about the series in total is kind of how, like, it just introduces and just drops characters. Like, so, for example, like, I kind of feel like with Chapter 2, with Common's character, like,
oh, yeah.
Why couldn't he come back?
Welcome to him.
Oh yeah, in the nice suit. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because him. Like he, you know,
he was aide to the female character who died. Yes, I'd forgotten it.
Now I can kind of see now, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, I can kind of see that in a kind of, well, he could be Donnie Yen's place in the duel bit.
They could call him back from retirement. Yeah, they wanted a blind guy because it's cool though.
Yeah,
or a blind character. Donnie Yen's not blind, but you know what I mean.
Because it could have been that kind of like development of like, well, you know, I know you didn't order it. It was just like you had to, but I have to try and kill you, out of like loyalty. It's all like they're all bound by this code of honor. But they kind of like it's kind of like a nice way that he gives them the fatal shot, but. They both walk away with what they want. Do you know what I mean? It's like that kind of thing.
That's
like
what I mean. They balanced the ending perfectly.
That would have been a perfect kind of like...
Yeah, but I mean, even in the context Kai finds of this film and absolutely accepting what you just said, yeah. I would hazard a guess there'd be very few people leaving the cinema who would resent Donnie Yen's character for having killed John Wick. The way the film panned out, everybody got a result, really.
Or... It's not necessarily Donnie Yen, it's like Mr. Nobody. Like, Common could have been like Mr. Nobody. Yeah,
I do like the fact that this film started with John Wick's compassion for dogs and finished with his life being saved by his compassion for a dog.
Exactly. I thought that was a big moment.
Like, he would have been killed if he hadn't saved that guy's dog.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense, yeah.
Had you thought about it, Chris? Because I've only just thought about it. Although I noticed it. I noticed at the time it was him saving the dog that saved him. But it's the thematic point of dogs.
The look on his face was just like, oh my God, really?
They've used something different in every film. You think at the end of the first film with the cars and, you know, him damaging himself and then getting the dog. And you think of this, you know, I can't remember which film it was where he was on a horse. And then, you know what I mean? And then this one, you've got, you know, vehicular mayhem in downtown Paris. And then you've got the stairwell. And I just think this film, but the second film was actually, if I had to rank it, I'd probably put it ahead of the third one, because it gives me now, when I think about it, more backstory on the world. Nice locations, but it was also a bit tighter. But I do remember in the second one, the action was just starting to get tired, because it was all this, wrestle a bit, flip them over, two quick bullets in the head. And by the time you're going into the second consecutive film of rinse and repeat action, no matter how good it was, that was starting to get tiresome. But since then, they've brought me something fresh every time.
I think they're kind of, this is going to sound really stupid, but it's kind of turning into like sort of like a Bond or a Bourne or like Mission Impossible, for example. I mean, the action set pieces, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And obviously, there's more globe hopping as well. We go across Europe, we go across Asia, trying to cover as many continents as we can, as many countries as we can, as many big capital cities as we can. We have to always go to America. But as well, like the big action set pieces, like how many ways can he fall out of a window? How many ways can he fall out in the street? How many cars can he crash? It just kind of gets getting bigger and better and more impressive.
It does.
And more highly stylized and more, you know, highly choreographed. I think this film is probably also, like the cinematography of it, it's probably the most prettiest film of the series, most beautifully shot and lit. Obviously, it's all heavily stylized, definitely, with lots of like mood lighting and really well-lit kind of set pieces. But it's definitely the most... I saw this film a couple of times, once a massive screen in Portsmouth. It was probably the most clearest picture I've seen. It's certainly sadly not the same at my local Odeon in Salisbury, unfortunately, which still got a really good picture, but not as good as the other one that I saw. And I was thinking, wow, this is very pretty. And I was speaking to friends who have seen it in IMAX and just said, yeah, it's probably like the most visually stunning of the series so far. But so for me, it kind of just keeps on getting better and better and better. So I would probably rank it quite highly as well, probably just behind the first one, I think.
Yeah, I think I'd go along with that. But they've all been great. I mean, it's just been a terrific series. And when you start critiquing any of them, it's all relative to what? They're all superb.
It is, definitely. Well, especially because I mean, there's quite a few films on our list that we're going to do that I probably haven't seen and I'm deliberately saving up. So like as I mentioned probably on our first review of when we started out doing the John Wick series, it had been like on my list. I'd missed it for whatever reason, and I think by the time the second or third one had rolled around, obviously I kind of, you know, tried to catch them all. I thought, well, it's a character I'm not really familiar with, you know, if it's based on a comic or whatever, I haven't seen it, I haven't read it, and therefore perhaps it wasn't for me for sure. But I'm kind of glad I did. I'm glad I did kind of seek them out. I sort of really enjoyed them. They are very very violent. Oh my God. Certainly this film as well, as they've gone on, it's like when I saw it the second time, I kind of mentioned in our little chat thread that we have, it was like, how many ways can you die? Like falling downstairs, falling out a window, falling onto a car, getting into a car, getting shot, getting, you know, death by playing card, when they get to the kind of
death by kick up the
series.
Bottom.
Yeah, death by kick up the bottom. You get shot in the bum, didn't they? Then ends up falling from a great height.
That was brutal, that.
That was very brutal. Oh my God, yeah. Literally crunch. Really randomly as well, I don't know if this is going to sound really stupid, but like different, when you guys saw it, did you have like any, how packed was your screenings? Did you have any like audience reactions or anything like that? So like when the character in Berlin kind of fell from a great height, did everybody go, ooh?
I had reactions like, and that's really rare because I'm not particularly... those sort of crunching impacts and stuff, you very rarely get a reaction from me. But I was aware, I kind of winced a few times.
Yeah, I don't know if you're like, oops, audience, the same. Because like the first time I saw it, they get quite a few audience reactions.
I wasn't affected by it. I was just like, it was almost like you could sort of feel it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. It's literally kind of bone crunching. I thought the sound and the Foley was very good as well. And it's, yeah, I think it's kind of, obviously the films are kind of known for not sort of cartoon, but like quite stylized kind of violence, really in a sort of highbrow quite way, definitely. But also like the when they get to Paris as well and they're calling out all these assassins, I think it's called Back to the Warriors, which is unfortunately one of those films I've just only recently seen.
If there's that many assassins in one city, what the fuck are they doing all day?
I know, they're not doing anything so they can come out at night.
It's strange that they're in Paris as well, all those bars, and how are they not all pissed?
Did they just basically say, like, we want to basically cordon off these stairs to the Sacré-Cœur, can we do it? And how, you know, did they basically block off the whole Arc de Triomphe so they could film at night? I just think that was incredible. And all the cars that they use as well.
I've always liked the sort of art style of this film anyway, the sort of future retro, almost it's not steampunk, but we got to invent a word for it.
Steampunk, no.
Well, it isn't steampunk because that's sort of Victorian with technology.
Yeah, that's
but,
got its own look
but
to it.
I thought of that term because I thought, is there a term for something that looks modern and 1950s and clean and yet covered in tattoos at the same time? There's got to be a word for that.
Yeah, I'm sure there is.
The staff at that bureau is
not steampunk.
Yeah, it's not steampunk, I know, but I was trying to think of a word
something
like
that, yeah, because they're all kind of like sort of 50s vintage retro kind of style-y, isn't it? So,
but covered in tattoos and like
covered in tattoos, and they bought the updos and lots of heavy makeup and stuff like that.
It's awesome, and it's all like ancient radios and stuff like that. So, wow, cool.
Yeah, it's all very kind of like hands-on, and she's got this big massive mic, yeah. And yeah, she actually plays records, and some of the, like the music's quite good as well. Like they play, like especially when they get to Paris as well, you've got some really interesting cover.
Well, that's more on that. The nose. In Paris, it's much more songs related to his predicament. But before that, it's all very music.
Exactly. But that's really cool, though. I like
it.
I like
switches
the thing
it up. Every action sequence has a different vibe.
Yeah, it's all different. It looks different. It's choreographed a different way. And it kind of it hits differently as well. Pun intended. Sorry about that. Yeah, definitely. It does pack a punch, definitely. But yeah, no, the points I wanted, like, stairs, obviously, like, basically, in a John Wick film, don't go up or down any stairs because it will be very painful. Interesting point about nunchucks as well, which I didn't realise, obviously, listening to Kermo's review again. Apparently, I think it's something to do with the head of the BBFC, who's now stepped down, and you've got Natasha Kaplinsky in charge. But apparently, nunchucks were banned for a while just because they were so dangerous.
That was,
I think,
James Furman's era.
That was a James Furman, yeah, it was due to probably the Ninja Turtles film or something.
I mean,
like
the thing
that
is, I don't want to slate these people because A, times change, and B, they were doing
I'm not slating, or, you know, I'm not saying it's a negative thing or anything like that.
They did what they thought was best, but it's just so wrong-headed. I mean,
that wasn't my point at all. I just thought it was amazing. It was because it's something, unless you're you know, as you watch those kind of Asian action movies, stuff like that, you don't see them very much over here, certainly.
But also, there was no idea that context is everything. It's fine.
No,
to,
exactly.
It's very difficult to say
also,
a blanket
just
ban
point,
on anything.
Sorry, just to say, sorry, Dave, just to finish sorry. My point, just to sorry. Say it's really refreshing to see that kind of weapon because of that ban, we haven't seen it for so long.
True.
And also, obviously, dogs that we've mentioned as well. I think it's really great to have a callback to Marlon Noir that we've seen in the previous films. Mr. Nobody, I think, was a really effective character. His performance was
I thought he was great. We haven't really made much of him, have we? He was great.
It was brilliant. I think that the best scene, I mean, I would agree that the Maquis is perhaps a bit, yeah, he is too young, a bit kind of the weak link. He's a really good character, obviously, played Pennywise in the It remakes. Very creepy. And he just, to be honest, he obviously the film is very well dressed, like the clothes and costumes and everything are all incredible. And each time he pops up in a new location, he wears a completely different suit. And he's probably one of the best dressed characters in the film. And I think my scene
well,
has been my favourite scene. Sorry.
I thought he looked like a dick, but
yeah, no, he did.
But then maybe that was a point.
No, exactly. That's it. I mean, he wears like these really ridiculously kind of like over the top kind of fine suits. Like when he's in, I don't know where it is, some palatial environment, and
he's
obviously Donnie,
he's
a blind character who can't see it. Yeah, that's it. And he's just wearing this ridiculous kind of suit and waistcoat and everything. I mean, just so finely dressed, you just think, oh my god, what an absolute dick. But they're all very smart, definitely. Also, there's a tenuous link to A View to a Kill because they film at Chateau Chantilly, and also the stables that they have.
Yeah, but
there,
I thought of A View to a Kill when he was in there because I just thought, you know.
Yeah, that's where they filmed
an old man should be fighting someone from EastEnders right now.
I've been there myself a few years ago with JBR. Actually going to the stables. Like,
some dotty old, aren't there? There'd be some stables.
Yeah, some dotty old, aren't there? Some horses.
Some old man should try and fuck someone really far, far too young for him right now.
I was half expecting Mayday to turn up and go, your helicopter leaves in 30 minutes in a random Russian accent. It's like, you're not Russian. What's going on? And Roger Moore to kind of be like, oh, you're waiting for me. And Christopher Walken didn't appear in this film. I was quite surprised. I thought, oh, Chateau Chantilly. But he's not there.
Well, so he probably doesn't live there, that's why. He probably just went there for a film nearly 40 years ago.
I was expecting him to turn up because it was View to a Kill. But
it's like getting into a taxi and thinking, why is Robert De Niro not in this?
Well, there's some Frenchman going around with half of my car. Oh, my car! Oh, my car!
My car! My car!
Drinking red wine.
With the getting it in one arm.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think is that it for John Wick, folks?
Is there anything more to say on it?
I mean, if we'd done 2 hours on it, we'd have done 2 hours on it. But I think we've said what we think of it. Definitely.
I'm definitely looking forward to it. I'm definitely going to watch it again soon. So it'd be nice to get like a whole holistic view of the series as a whole.
Absolutely, I'd agree with that. I have been tempted in the last few days to just watch the first three again, so I'm likely to. I mean, every now and again I get like an Amazon voucher or something, I'll just pick them up because I do enjoy them. I do enjoy them very much, and actually they feel much more different from each other's. If you think about them long enough in your mind's eye, they are actually much more distinctive from each other than you might think or might remember. Anyway.
Well, you can pick up both 1 and 2 on iTunes for £8.
Okay.
And I think the third film would only be like...
Well, they're £4.99 each on Amazon at the moment.
And the third film is only probably about a fiver on iTunes, so
yeah,
that's for three films.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not 4K, bad at all.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing about iTunes has more in 4K than Amazon does. Amazon is catching up, but it's not there yet.
And that does come with iTunes Extra as well, so...
That's another thing. Amazon, it's the exception, not the rule. Parabellum is still on Prime Video, but only for a few more days, so it'll be fewer days by the time this is released. But, yeah. All right, as for social media, you can follow me at the Pasty Kid 1976 on Twitter.
You can find me on Cinematronics on Twitter. You can find all the episodes on Poppy.
If you want, you can follow me on Twitter at RVMovies, but you can also follow us on Twitter at Expect Us to Talk.
We've already said what's next on the last episode, because this is a little Brucey bonus for you. So we'll be back next time with Once Upon a Time in the West, which I'm so excited about because I love that film so much.
Can't wait.
Honestly, there's just some films that you get. I wouldn't say this isn't an example of this, but there were certainly films when we did Bond, I was almost nervous to talk about them because I thought I've got one shot to talk about why this film's one so shot. Special. But you know what I mean? It's like, you know, when a film means a lot to you and you finally talk about it on a recording that you hope's going to last a while and people will find at different times over the years.
Exactly. Yeah, this is what I was like up. With Jane about the Bond films. I was like, yes.
You don't want to go like, oh, fuck that up. I was waiting for this.
Yeah. Hitchcock, I'll be like, yeah, my God. Anyway,
so I'm just going to say, good night, folks. Does everyone else want to say goodbye as well?
It's good night for me.
It's good night for her.
Ta-ta.